Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life, there's no surrender. There's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. With our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers, we are soldiers.
That song, by the way, folks, and thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And if you are a Facebook user, you can find the Patriot Journalist Network just by putting the words in your search engine, just Patriot Journalist Network, and you will find not only this show, but you will also find the show of Mark Prasik, which is Full Armor, which you can find from Monday through Friday from 8 p.m. till midnight Eastern Time, and that is a live video chat. So go by and say hello to Mark for me. I haven't had the opportunity to speak with him for a while, so that would be nice, and perhaps one day I'll be able to get there soon. But thank you for listening, whether you're listening from Blog Talk Radio or from the Bard's Logic Political Talk website, which if people would like to visit, that would be great. Send me a message from the contact page of the website. And also, if you're listening to this on the archives or through other ways of listening to the show, I thank you once again for listening. So tonight, after the free and equal debate, Bard's Logic will compare and contrast some of the candidates from last night's debate, namely Virgil Goode and Gary Johnson. And hopefully, at least for me, that would be a precursor to the debate on October 30th in Washington, D.C. Of course, I wouldn't mind hearing Jill Stein a little bit again, to be honest, being an environmentalist. I'd like to hear more from her, of course. I'd like to see more of a conservative stance towards environmental protection, sustainability, and conservation, which I don't know if I'd see too much out of the Green Party now as it stands. However, it is also a third party, which is part of the grassroots, what I like to call the We the People Party. And I've got a couple of the folks in the line. I've got the one of the members of the Bard's Logic panel, Chris. So I will be opening up his mic, and I will also open up the mic of Randy, or Gunny, as he sometimes calls himself, and I will open up the mic to them as well. So thank you, Chris. Thank you, Randy, for calling in tonight. How are you?
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Yes, me too.
It's going to be a really good show, Robert.
Would we lose Robert already?
The gunny scared him away.
I have not been lost. I just don't want to interrupt you folks. No, but as I say, it's going to be a good show, and it was a good day because what I talked briefly with each of you about is I actually had the opportunity to meet up with Mr. Good today and have some lunch for about 40 minutes. He was here in Ohio on his way back from the debate last night, and let me tell you, he is one down-to-earth individual. It was just amazing, someone of his stature, just being such a easily to talk to a person as he was pretty pretty awesome. I must say. And, of course, I can go into details later, but go ahead, Chris or Randy, whichever would like to start. Go ahead.
Well, no, I want to hear about your – you started with the good thing, so tell the story.
Yeah.
While you're doing that, I'll get ready.
Just to reiterate, I've known Virgil for a number of years now. And you can tell by his accent, he's a Southerner. But I tell you, he's also a Southern gentleman. And
yes, he is
a real gracious individual. And got to see his wife, with him last night as well. And she's quite the elegant lady as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and she was there. She was there as myself, his wife. Somebody actually from the Libertarian Party, and another gentleman, and it's really cool. And speaking of gentlemen, when I talked to him this morning, because I called him about 11 a.m. and to find out where they were going to be, and I said, I just don't know if I'm gonna be able to make it because it was like an hour and 40 minute drive for me to get where they were going. And he said, well, if you get close and it gets close to the time that we think we might be leaving, which would have been around 1 o'clock, he said, give me a call and we'll wait for you. And I was like, wow, that's, I was really impressed with that. He's like, oh, we'll wait for you. And I'm like, that's just a, as I said, down to earth, a gentleman. So I was really impressed. I mean, just, something you wouldn't think, you'd get from an Obama or a Romney by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, right. them self-imported, self-deluded individuals. Virgil mm-hmm. understands the race. He understands the problem that we face. And boy, I'm a poet too. But it really is. And I had a chance to talk with him a little bit last night, ask him a few questions, to get a little bit deeper understanding. But I've known Virgil for about 3 years now, and it's certainly he's been a great guy. I've really enjoyed getting to know him, but I tell you, these last 6 months I have developed a tremendous amount of respect for who he is and the man he is, and his love for our country and the desire to save this country from the brink of disaster that we're headed to. And the fact that he's willing to do this in a third party venture, to me, speaks absolute volumes about who this man really is.
Yeah, definitely. It was him and his wife driving in their car, traveling around where they need to go, for their campaign, for the debate. And then, of course, they'll find out, if he's got to travel to Washington, D.C. Really? I got my headset. Is something wrong with it?
Something's weird. It's like kind of
really?
Thing every so often.
I apologize for that. Okay, well, I've got my headset. Hopefully nothing's wrong with that. Is that better?
I don't know. It hasn't come back.
It just happens intermittently. Okay.
Does it happen when the gunny's talking?
Well, it was happening just when Robert was talking, so I don't know who it was.
Indeed. Okay. Well, it's all the static electricity in there. It's all the excitement side. That's what that is.
It could have been my magnetic personality, too, but, you know, you never know.
Quite possibly. but yes, as you know, as I was saying, they're just traveling in their, in their vehicle, and if they get, if they have to go to Washington D.C., if they're one of the two, if Virgil's one of the two candidates, that's going to be on the debate on October 30th, which would be next Tuesday, from the free and equal debate. Then, of course, they'll just take their, of course, I think he's from Virginia, so that would be. A shorter drive. I remember at lunch today we were leaving. They said, "Yeah, they had about a 7 to 9 hour drive still to go from from where we're at in Ohio."
Yeah, and I can certainly identify with that travel. I mean, we had to drive 5 hours up to the debate and 5 hours back, and of course, we didn't get out of there till probably after 10:30, and then had to, make a couple of stops along the way. So I didn't even get home till about 4:30 this morning.
Well, I wonder if he even had breakfast this morning, because that's what he had for lunch, like eggs and hash browns and biscuits for lunch. And I'm like, oh, this poor guy probably didn't even get a chance to eat breakfast this morning.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, I don't know.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, it was a very interesting experience. I'm glad I got the opportunity and, to actually sit down, and speak with them, it was pretty interesting. And then, of course, we talked, politics, of course, about, how much money that both of the other candidates, Obama and Romney spent on this, and talked about super PACs and his desire to get rid of super PACs and just have it be where, just individual contributions. They talked about that and, things of that nature.
And let me tell you, one of the things that you didn't hear, that he didn't really specify last night, is that Virgil is not taking any PAC money, any special interest money, any corporate money. The only thing he is accepting is money from individuals, and only up to $200, regardless of who that person is. So, he's leveling the playing field to demonstrate he is not going to be a bought candidate, and look at the tremendous difference in the impact that he's having, even at that level.
And it looks like, gentlemen, we have someone else on Skype calling in, and since I do not have any sort of number here, and they do look like they'd like to chime in, I just have two roles here on Bard's Logic Political Talk when it comes to the callers. Is one, of course, we do not have profanity, and two, that you just show respect for the hosts and the guests. And if just either one of these two rules are broken, that's one benefit of being the host, is you have a button which can kick people off. I very rarely have ever had to do that, and I'm not presuming that someone will. I just want to put that out there because we have had some issues in the past. So I will let this person in if they could just introduce themselves, tell us where they're calling from, and tell us what's on their mind. Your mic is open.
My name is Dale Dortz. I'm with the Constitution Party of Illinois, and I'm running for state rep in 117. And I've been on Sammy's show before, but I just wanted to put my little input in on. I had a question for you guys, but I've watched all the debates, and Goode has won everyone, in my opinion. He's a true constitutionalist, and that's what we need to get our country back together. But my question is, I've been fighting with Randy for a few years now, on Facebook and everything, trying to get his name out there, or just get our name out there. And then when he was, our candidate, to get his name out there. But how do we really put a force on the media, unlike the national media, to recognize us? That's my question.
That's a great question. Has anybody ever picked up the phone and actually called them and said, why don't you do this? Why won't you? You know, I mean, we all know why they don't do it, because they're controlled by the same. They're controlled by the same people that control the super PACs, that control the lobbyists, that control the globalists. I mean, there's the reason, you know.
Go ahead, Chris.
And until that system's broken, or until third parties rise to a point of where they can no longer ignore it, I don't think anybody's going to do crap, to be honest with you, because it's the same criminals.
And let me say before the Bard chimes in here that that's exactly what this media is all about. You know, using blog talk, using all other forms of media to get out there, hit all the blogs and all that, because at least for now, I know they're trying to put the, you know, our government's trying to put the controls on the internet so they can limit our voice here as well. But for now, you know this is the medium where we can really make an impact.
And that's true, and I've said even in the beginning, you know, of doing the show, and when I was a guest on Sammy's show on a number of occasions, as I said, look, I think that, you know, places such as Blog Talk Radio and just the internet, indeed, is going to be the new media of the 21st century. One, because folks can go out and do their own research and not have to get any news from talking heads such as those you'll find on Fox News or Faux News and, you know, in other places. And also, it could be a lot more interactive, such as what we hear, you know, on this show, on Bard's Logic, and, of course, other shows such as you mentioned Samuel Sanford's, as well as the Tex and Rex show that the folks here are familiar with. So it's very interactive. People can call in. They can participate in chat, you know, things of that nature. And I think that really brings the news, so to speak, really home to people. And once it gets widespread and gets out there, I really think it can take over, as I said, the new media for the 21st century.
Well, I will say, it just in response to one thing you said, Robert, you know, you said people can do the research. The problem is that we have such a lazy and apathetic American electorate, or should I say voters, or even those that don't vote. They want it hand-fed. You know, they want it delivered to them on a platter so that they don't have to do any of the research or any of that stuff. And so, you know, and I think that's one of the things that Chris is really working on, is to deliver, you know, the information to them on a silver platter. And I'm finding I'm having to do that, you know, quite frankly, at some of the impetus of Chris.
Not as ad nauseum.
Yeah, you know, so I'm trying to get that. I'm actually working with our state leaders to try to get all of the information of these candidates. So, you know, it's tough.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. I've built organizations and trained people in profit and nonprofit environments most of my life, or my adult life, and or at least from about 30 on. So I've got about 20-some years of experience in doing this, and I know what it takes to move the masses. You got to understand, it doesn't take anything to move a person like me, because I'm curious, and I want to know, and I want to be informed, and I want answers. I went out and learned about Ron Paul on my own, and that is what led me to the third-party conversation. Guys like me don't need an information source. I need access and for people to give me answers when I ask them. That is not the average citizen. The average citizen, when they get excited, okay, you have to be able to deliver viable information to them in a way that they can understand it. That's an educational environment. leaders don't need an education environment. Well, most people are not leaders. And I'm not trying to, you know, make anybody feel bad with that information. That's just a fact about dealing with human nature. And what we're finding, and I see the same tone on the internet. I find that people, you know, even though that's their environment, it still has to be delivered to them. And so you have to build simple ways when you catch somebody's attention, you know, whether it be an issue or a debate or whatever, that you want to lead them to good information, the more efficient you are
at doing that, then the faster you get your message out there, because it's, if it's easy for them and they catch it and go, wow, this is cool, then it's easy for them to pass it on. And that's like what that that chat message I sent you today, and I sent you the link to your competitive party. You know, when they click, when you click on, when they click on a state, it's got a little picture and the information of the person running in that state with the information. And it's amazing how something that simple, which is data management, which you understand, how important that is when you're leading people to that unknown, because it's an unknown. They don't know who the Constitution Party is. And that, and so those are the kind of things that are natural for me to catch, I guess. You know what I mean, and talk about.
You know, and that's where the mainstream media has the advantage, because all people have to do is push a little
button.
Turn it on. Force-fed right down their throat. So, you know, we've got certainly a huge hill that we have to overcome. In fact, I'd say a cliff. We've got to climb this cliff and overcome it, because they do have such a tremendous advantage over us on it.
Well, not just, you know, let's say ignore, I mean, I don't want to ignore mainstream media, because they do impact.
Real quick, Chris, I mean, I just want to ask Dale, would that answer your question? Actually, it did.
The gentleman that was just speaking, and I don't know his name. I'm sorry about that, but that was a very, very good answer, because we have, you know, with my campaign, we started about 3 weeks ago, and for 3 weeks running, just on Facebook alone, we've reached 65,000 people in my district every week. So. And my group is growing tremendously. I mean, it does cost money, but that is a very good answer, because I think a lot people with wisdom, I think, actually look everything up. But I think we have a problem with how do I word this? People that go with the flow, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Type of thing, and they just ignore everything, and they really don't. I talked to my dad yesterday and my mother, and they're both Obama fans, and it kills me. And they were like, they said, "Well, do you like Mitt?" And I was like, "No, I don't like him either." You know what I mean? I try to discuss it to them, and they get mad at me. And I try to tell them, I was like, "Look, I can have the proof right here in front of you, you know, but you still are stuck in your ways." So I don't know. Just a little frustrated,
well,
but I think
Dale,
the internet is the way to go.
Yeah, but there's also a dynamics of the internet, and one is how to consolidate your information and so you get it to people efficiently. Then the other thing is, how do you work against disinformation? I mean, there's a lot of maybe I should put all this down on paper, because this is my background, but I do it all the time, but I'm not always teaching people about it. I know Randy and I are always crashing different, and same with Robert in terms of getting the show out. But we, you know, we've been censored since we started talking about third parties. So we have pretty fresh information about what happens when you try to talk about the good news. It's almost like, I don't want to bring up religion into the conversation, but, you know, trying to talk about the good news, you know, and you're
right.
Censored from it. And so there's two factors to any strategy, but your data has to be efficient. Your website, your Facebook, what you do on Facebook. I know that I don't know any Facebook group I've ever seen like what I do on mine, because I never really built mine for a chit-chat room. I built it to educate people, because that's how I think. You know, I'm a freak in that arena. You know, I mean, I just grew up with teachers. I can't help it, man. It's ingrained into my soul. You know, everything for me, there goes that. Must be aliens. We're getting censored again. But and so you have to deal with those two parallel environments, which you guys understand being third-party people. Nobody wants you to get your message out. We've now shared that pain with you, because we were all excited and then got slammed. You know, we used to have hundreds and hundreds of groups that we could post our shows on, and they started slamming us down and kicking us off and because
right.
They don't want that information out there. So in the strategy of the future – you know, it has to be a two-pronged, I'm thinking military now, but it has to be two-pronged. You have to realize you have the information of disinformation, and you have the information of how do I get this message across to people who are as soon as I catch their attention, I've got to be able to deliver, you know, enough information to them to draw them in farther, because there's no way in one conversation you can tell them everything they need to know. It's a learning curve.
Right.
So there's another component to it. So there's a lot to this. And unfortunately, I wish I could say we don't have time, but we do have time because, and it's what I said with Randy earlier today, I wish I would have known what I know today, because I could have been applying these things all year. And I, you know, I'm so new to you guys. I just didn't know. And so, you know, hopefully we can move forward from here and we can help everybody get their systems and their delivery and their strategies and their wording. You know, it's like I told Randy, there's something I'm brewing because you guys are the real Tea Party. You know, what these Tea Parties are representing is nothing more than a political game. Well, I don't want to say all of them. Okay, let me take that back, because the Tea Party is not one organization. But you know, many of them have been co-opted into the Republican Party. That, in some ways, was a huge mistake. You know, they should have stayed separate from the party because they would have had more power. You know, but they fell right into the same methodology and patterns. You know, because, I mean, a lot of people don't understand, but political parties, the concept of how a political party, I mean, the foundations of any organization have been around and a part of our lives in everything, whether it's the Elks or Republican Party or, you know, or whatever. It's just, it's a thing. It's part of our culture that goes back all the way back to England. Anyway, I'm babbling on that one. But, yeah, no, I feel your pain every day. In fact, I feel it right now. Because I'd love to be able to reach, you know, millions of people. When we get people to quit worrying about... Go ahead.
When I first started this little adventure about 5 years ago, you know, and then I ran into the Constitution Party 2.5-3 years ago, and, you know, since I've been running for office, there's so much that I want to say, but I have to be careful because I'm afraid, you know what I mean? Because everybody's like, you got to be politically correct. You got to be, you can't be, you know, an activist, and you can't be this or that, and it's like, I know it's short right now. It's like 2 weeks away, and so now I'm kind of like, I'm just, I don't know. I guess I'm just being a candidate that's a new candidate that's kind of freaking out. I've reached a lot of people, don't get me wrong, and I've wrote some stuff that I shouldn't have wrote, you know what I mean, that I did with a newspaper, that this is what kills me. When I've got someone tell me that, well, you shouldn't have said that in the newspaper, this and that. But 100% of the people I've talked to that seen my ad in the newspaper said, hey, you are straightforward, and we like that. You know what I mean? That's, you know what I mean? It's crazy.
Well, see, and guys like us, we can say what we want because we don't have anything at risk. We're not running for anything. You know, and they can't, what are they going to do, come back in next year and say, well, you said this a year ago. I'm going to like, so what? Nobody's paying me and I ain't running for anything. You say what the hell I want to say. You know, that is right. you know, and I'm sure Randy has got some wisdom for you there too, because I've been in that place where I had to watch, you know, living in a glass house in different environments in my life where I had to watch what I said, how I said it, you know, everything. I mean, how you shake a hand, you know, how you hug a woman, you know, how you do it a certain, you know, all these politically correct things that you have to be careful of, because somebody, your enemy, is going to come along and use everything they can to destroy you. And so that's an unfortunate thing to, you know, living in a glass house is a curse and a blessing at the same time. You know, and I'm sure Gunny has crossed the line a few times.
Well, you know what's funny is I you said that, and my wife is in the background listening, laughing. Okay.
Oh, I'm sure.
My wife too. Live in a glass house, Chris, and make sure it's obsidian.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, my wife is like in my son's room, and so my son can my handicapped son can listen when I'm on the radio. Obviously, I can't do that when I'm on the phone. So I'm in my office. And she'll come in, every once in a while she'll come, like, you know, and look in the office going, Don't say that. You know. So, yeah, thank God for wives, right?
wives with pins in their hands so they can pop our big heads, right?
Yeah.
And speaking of the ladies, I'd like to thank Arlene taking up for me, and not while I was being attacked or anything, that you really did really great promoting tonight for me, and I really want to say thank you and that I appreciate that for doing that, because I didn't get to it as much as I would like to up today. Yeah, with us men, we dropped the ball, and as I said, and I'll say it again, behind every great man is a great woman, and vice versa. So, but go ahead, guys. I just want to
I think this leads into the first question of the debate, and I think that we can expand on this as we talk, because the first question of the debate was the lack of mainstream media and the political parties giving them a fair, free and balanced, what was the organization called it?
Fair and balanced.
Free and equal.
Yeah, free and equal. You know, and so there's another venue there, and that's awesome that more and more and more people are picking up on it. And I think a lot of that has to do with social media, because the only place that was put out was either on the internet or C-SPAN, which C-SPAN has always been a little bit more fair. You know what I'm saying, as a news organization.
Let me give you a little bit of insight there, though, because I actually talked to some of the folks. There's a guy by the name of Zach, and I don't remember what his last name is, but he's a member of the Free and Equal, and he was a part of the team that was actually putting emails out there to various organizations about, hey, we're holding a debate if you'd like to come and cover it. And he was going out there. He connected with, in fact, I know for a fact, I talked to some of them. There was a British reporter there, somebody from the UK. There was a French. There was the Japanese that were there covering this event. And actually, the Al Jazeera, you know. And I think it was, you know, by and large, it was kind of interesting. C-SPAN had not till the last minute indicated that they were going to cover it. They covered the 2008, but they were trying to get it covered earlier by C-SPAN, and C-SPAN wasn't having it. And I think it was the international interest in this to debate that caused the national media's interest, because it kind of forced them into acknowledging we've got a debate. And of course, the name of Larry King being added to, you know, all of it, they were forced into acknowledging it. And so we had C-SPAN, apparently the Wall Street, Washington Post, New York Times, I think, was there and had, you know, did their own coverage and stuff. So, you know, we had some coverage there, but they didn't do it because they agreed with what we were doing. You know, there's two reasons why the media comes in there, and it's either they've got an agenda or it's all about money. And I think they were afraid of losing some money if they didn't come in there and cover it when all the other international interests were there covering it.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. And I don't know how to respond on the C-SPAN thing, you know, but I can see what you're saying. But, you know, I think that one thing it was really interesting, because you had four people, and you had two of them are you know, left-wing socialists, if not on the edge of communists. but it was funny, because they want more government. They want federal laws across the land controlling all of it. They want the federal government to pay for it. You know, and I love Virgil's response. Actually, you know, Virgil and Johnson, I'm going to give Johnson a lot of kudos as we go down through this on several things, because, you know, he has the same attitude now. And I know what you're thinking already, Randy. Johnson is taking has super PACs now. So, you know, I already knew that.
Yep.
But,
okay.
But the thing is that Good, I love his answer, both in the pre-debate conversation and in the debate. He's saying, you know, he talks about his limits on personal donations, which I don't understand, because the law says $2,500. I don't know why he doesn't do it, but whatever. But the other thing is, you know, get rid of these super PACs, get rid of these action committees, and you can't have the federal government come in and tell states what to do. Now, that's a constitutionalist. If anybody out there listening wants to understand,
we've interviewed Virgil Goode and Clymer twice, Jim Clymer twice, and one of the best questions that Rex ever asked. Well, he always asks great questions, but he asked a question of Jim Clymer about, you know, changing all these illegal executive orders and laws. And Jim Clymer said, yeah, you know, you want to, but we're not going to break the law and abuse the Constitution to do it. And that,
Chris,
that gave me so much respect right there.
And, Chris, I'm going to chime in real quick and be a little narcissistic here for a second. But and actually, we just Monday night had an interview with Jim Clymer. So the folks who have not seen the – or not seen, but heard the interview – yeah, you can go in the archives and find it from Monday nights. And two, speaking of a Virgil Goode interview, Virgil Goode will be on, slotted to be on this show tomorrow night, which Thursday night as well. So I'm really looking forward to that. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's all. I'm looking forward to that too. And hopefully I get the rest of the debate broken down. I had multiple calls and talking to a gentleman in California on some things that are going on down there. But I think that the fact that they're talking about the corruption and they're talking about, you know, the duopoly and they're talking about this stuff, I think that we have a rumbling occurring, even though we all of us feel so far behind the eight ball right now in terms of what we could be doing, you know, if we had all of our systems in place and could get the information out to people. But I think that there's something occurring and people are picking up on it. And fortunately, you know, I think at the end, when they get the numbers of how many people voted third party, you know, that's the thing I said way back when I first started investigating this was, you get a real number. If you break, what's his name? Perot. If you break his numbers, it's historical, and it changes our politics.
Well, let me
forever.
Tell you something. I was
let me say that
you couldn't see it from. I mean, there was even a camera that took a shot from the very back, all the way across the audience and to the front. What you couldn't see was the huge number of people that were attending this event. I don't know what the number was. It had to have been somewhere between 500 to 1,000 people in that little auditorium that was there. And, you know, and that was despite the fact that we had to overcome the fact that there was no mainstream media advertising it. We had people coming in from all across the country. I talked to folks that, yeah, I just heard about this on and came in from Indiana and Ohio and some of these other places wanting to be a part of this historical event 4 years ago. You could have fit five people in the auditorium, and that would probably have been enough. But they, in fact, based upon, you know, the past, they started off with, you know, they were going to hold it at the University of Chicago. But, you know, they got the inclination that this thing's going pretty viral, and it did. And so, you know, so what you didn't see was the huge number of people that were present at this third party, and that's the one thing that gives me hope. I've been at this fight for years, and this is the first time that I've seen people actually not only kind of wake up, but actually get out of bed to do something.
Yeah, that's awesome. And at this point, Dale, to see if you would like to chime in on any of that, since I still see your line out there.
Yeah, I was just letting Randy say his little piece.
Well, of course, of course. I just want to open up for you to chime in if you'd like. Go ahead.
Okay. I was just going to say that's absolutely terrific because, you know, even on our state and local level, people are kind of afraid, but it's a lot easier, you know, reaching people at this level. But when you have a national level like that and you have so many people showing up, I mean, that really says a lot, you know, because – my job as a constitutionalist with the Constitution Party of Illinois, you know, my job is to get people in place to run for office at our state and local level because that's what I believe is going to make the difference. You know, it doesn't really matter to me about president, you know what I mean, because our state and local level is what we got to start from and we got to build from again, like just like teaching instead of our teachers teaching our kids, we got to teach our kids and let our teachers be our assistants. You know, so in saying that, since I'm looking at such a small level just in my area, and Randy, I wanted to go so bad, but I had a meeting last night for a campaign donation. But just for Randy going to something like that at that level and everybody showing up from all over is saying that America is tired of it. We, you know, people are scared and they don't want to step outside the box because they don't want to be labeled this and that. But a lot more people will sit here on their couch in the living room and say, hey, I'm a constitutionalist. I know what's going on. I know what Jane Fonda is. You know what I mean? It's crazy. And Randy, I just got to say, Randy's doing, like, an awesome job. He is the bomb, dude. He is doing an awesome job. And well, it's incredible just the things that he's doing.
No, when I was talking with Virgil today, he mentioned Randy. You know how hard he's working. He's like, oh, he's a hard worker. He's, you know, got a lot that he's been doing. So he definitely is recognizing that as well.
Yeah, Randy's my mentor, by the way.
Oh God, I feel sorry for you. No, I'm just kidding.
And my wife says, yeah, me too.
well
you know,
think,
but Dale's building me up entirely too big. He's got people that are scared to call me. I'm like, man, I'm nobody. I'm just a pissed off gunny. That's all it is.
Yeah.
See, just
well,
just
you know, you're
going to
look back. Well, you're going to look back, and you're going to realize that these times were some of the most valuable times because the hardest journey. And you look, you've heard the. You know, I used to do this in teaching environments all the time. You know, the amount of energy it takes to get a rocket off the ground, you know, 90% of it is the energy is in the first 100 feet or so. You know, it takes a lot to get a ship moving, the amount of energy it takes to get a car started, whatever you want to call it, you know, keeping things going. And so this battle that you're fighting right now, all of us, you know, that are fighting right now is important times because that builds the system and the character. And if it was easy, then you'd be another Republican Party. You know, it'd already be there. Another corrupt system full of a bunch of people who are coming in to get elected so they can get rich and throw their weight around and get their buddies good deals with the government. And that's not what you guys want to build with your party. You know, yeah. And so, you know, it doesn't make you feel any better because I know what it's like to be in those beginning stages, but it's important. I think another key, and I'm probably one of the biggest voices on this, has been the down ballot access. Because even, you know, when I get over to my Ron Paul group friends, you know, who are having the battle between losing people to Johnson and wanting to stay in the party and wanting to do the right in Ron Paul thing, you know, I can't get up and say, hey, you need to look at Virgil Goode because I'd be in the middle of a war that's already going on. But when I talk to people, I'm starting to get more and more people the conversation out about, hey, regardless of the top of the ticket, you know, whatever you do, we need constitutional people in the congressional level, state level, sheriffs, governors, and there's X amount of people out there in these two parties, and you got people you can vote for without violating your top of the ticket. You know, you follow what I'm getting at.
Right.
And I'm finally getting people to come around and ask me serious questions about who these people are.
And that was kind of the brilliance of what Cynthia Davis did there in Missouri. Rather than run for the top of the ticket for the governor's race, where everybody would be like, oh, you're going to split the vote, you know.
How did that go, Randy?
It's on recording.
She went for the governor's race.
Yeah, to rewind that.
Say,
you know what's better, though? Do you guys know what's better, though? I got to tell you, and Randy, I'm sorry to put you out here again, but my son, one time, we went to Springfield, and my son got to file my papers running for state rep, and
that's
he
cool.
heard something that Randy said, and because Randy is a Marine for 22 years, and my son is wanting to be a Marine, okay? My son, I got a pretty tough son, and he said that Randy said we need another George Washington. So he's like, Dad, maybe I'll be the next George Washington. That right there, I'm telling you, that's what gives me hope because my kids are learning it. You know what I mean? It's like we got to bring this back to our kids. You know what I mean? Get them back involved. And Randy's doing this new thing, and I'm sorry, Randy, for not joining yet, but with young constitutionalists, and it's like Randy is a true patriot, and that's what we have to hit on is our kids.
You know, it's not easy to make me shut down very often, you know. But thanks, Dale.
Well, and one of the things I like to do is the two candidates. And before I say this, is if you have not gone to the Free and Equal website to vote for the candidates who would possibly be on next week.
Robert, I think it's too late now. They shut it down.
I thought it was 24 hours. I see.
They stopped it at 9 p.m.
No, okay, I'm an hour behind schedule tonight. That's probably why I can get that screwed up. Well, I guess it's too late to do that. But one of the things, you know, I'd like to, you know, talk about tonight is, I guess the two candidates that were the closest together, I guess in ideology, not quite message, but, you know, I guess what you could see where there's some conservatism is between Virgil Goode and Gary Johnson. And I know in some ways they work together, but other ways they would be competing for some of the same folks. What would be a way to differentiate between the two, maybe as I put in the description here, compare and contrast the two candidates?
Well, Robert, I think that's pretty easy, and I think it's focused on one word. Virgil is what we would call a social conservative, and Gary Johnson is a social liberal. Now, he might be looking at the Constitution and looking at fiscal and, you know, those kind of things as a conservative view. But when it comes to those social issues such as pro-choice, you know, homosexual issues, pornography, and all of those other social issues, I think there's a great divide between the two.
Well, I think last night I made a note of it when Johnson said, you know, I'm pro everything. I'm he really alienated a lot of people, I think. Yeah, and trying to not alienate a lot of people, I think he did the exact opposite of what his intentions were. I mean, that's just my opinion.
Not with the audience that was out there.
Not with the audience. True. I'm talking about for the people watching, not for the audience. And I made a comment.
Bertha mentioned he would defund the Planned Parenthood, and if you listen to the clip, I'm the one who goes, woo! And everybody else is like, woo! And I'm like,
oh, I know. Well, I think I mentioned that to Chris last night, or on the show last night. There was a little commentary after we covered the debate. As I said, you know, I think that there's a lot of liberals in the crowd. I think more than 50% of the maybe not liberal, but at least socially. So,
98% to 99% liberal on the social issues.
Well, my you've been around the third parties longer than I have, and Rex, you know, has history with the Libertarian Party, and Kelly does, but I don't want to say unfortunately because he's out camping with his son, so that's a good thing, but. That the Libertarian Party has made some changes lately, if I understand. And I think Gary is bringing even more changes to the party with his positions, because my understanding is the Libertarian Party has been, you know, it's personal choice, it's up to individuals, or that's not a federal issue, that's a state's issue, but they never necessarily took a strong stance on those. Am I wrong in saying that until recently?
Well, you know, I want to say that up until recently, the Libertarian platform contained the fact that they were absolutely pro-choice. Now they've kind of gone with, you can be whatever choice you want, whether that's pro-choice or pro-life now. So,
but they were pro-choice before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was contained within their platform.
Okay. And forever?
I have no idea what the time frame was on that, you know, when it actually got put in there and that sort of thing. I just know that it's been recently that it's been removed out of there as an official position of the party.
Okay. Well, you guys chit chat for a minute on this. I've got to do a message, whatever you call it, PM. PM just sounds weird to me. PM sounds like I got to do a BM. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Well, we don't have that kind of talk here. I'm just kidding, Chris.
Yeah.
Go ahead, guys.
Well, you know, it was kind of funny, you know, when Larry King read the list of rules and how they would transpire. And I just watched the debate again, at least the first part of it. And Larry certainly read the first thing we're going to do is do opening statements. And then when they went on to the first question, he says, well, I didn't know we were supposed to do opening statements. Well, he had actually read it. I went back to make sure. But anyway, they dealt with the top two issue. Now, what's kind of funny, it really is kind of somewhat humorous in a sense that you know, free and equal is absolutely opposed to the top two system of politics. But and then what they're doing is they are narrowing their debate next week to the top two.
Yeah, I found that ridiculous.
You know, well, I have no idea what the premise is behind it, but I did find out, interestingly, one of the reasons why they are having it is that Ralph Nader is one of the biggest supporters, and Ralph Nader, you know, has a little bit of a chunk of change behind him.
Yeah, he's been in. Well, here's another thing, too. Yeah. I actually read on one of my Paul friend sites groups that I'm on that they were making a comment about the fact that, you know, Johnson has filed these, you know, lawsuits and been fighting to get on the, you know, on the national debate against the top two people, blah, blah, blah. And they're surprised that he let this happen without a glitch, without saying, hey, this isn't fair, because this is exactly what the top two does. And somebody made that analogy. I know that my frustration when I heard that was going, well, this is stupid because they only covered six questions, you know, and you know, they barely got into, I mean, six questions isn't a debate. Robert and I ask more questions of that of your candidates when we get them on in the first 30 minutes.
Right.
You know, and I'm thinking that's not, I got so fired up about this. And then when I heard that, and I would feel the same if Gooden Johnson were the last two, it's not right. It negates the whole concept of what they claim they were trying to do. This isn't a runoff to who's going to win. This is a chance for the third parties to have a voice.
Right.
You know, I
don't disagree with you. I know the heart is to level the playing field for all, you know, third party independent candidates to make it a fair and equal part. So I know that's at the heart of it. So in giving them the benefit of the doubt, you know, they may be having to play a little bit of the game with some of the folks to at least get some of these candidates out in front of the light so that they can, you know, keep pushing the third party debate effort. So, I mean, it may have been somebody else that made those constraints, and they're like, well, if we're going to do it, we're going to have to knuckle down to certain constraints. So, you know, just giving them
the people
where they come from, you know, I might suggest that they may be going with that.
You know, sorry, go ahead, Robert. I'm going to
call. No, real quick, Chris. No, go ahead, and I'm going to let someone in and answer or ask your question. And then 954, I see you on the line. I'm going to open up your mic, and then Chris will complete his question and Randy answer. And then 954, you can chime in with what's on your mind.
Yeah, here's the question, Randy. Do you know these people? Have you dealt with them because you're part of the upper echelon of the party?
Well, you know, I know Christina Tobin. I've known her since 2006. And, you know, I was brought in as a member of the board of directors for free because they know how much I believe in leveling the playing field. And certainly I do have a bias for the Constitution Party. But I believe, you know, as you've heard me, I'm fighting to destroy the two-party duopoly. I just view the Constitution Party as the best platform to do that from. But to see all parties brought into brought into this. So I know Christina Tobin pretty well. I've over 6 years now, and she's the primary driving force. But you know, you also got to know that she was the ballot access coordinator for the Green Party here in Illinois when they actually got on the ballot, got 16% of the vote, and became an established party statewide for 4 years. And then in 2008, she was a part of the Nader Raiders. So she was, I think, the national ballot access coordinator for Ralph Nader's presidential race in 2008. So, you know, she's kind of hopscotching around, you know, the various things. But I think it just demonstrates, you know, that she's not beholden to any particular party, but that she's truly bent on trying to level the playing field and destroy the duopoly.
Well, is there a chance that you can actually have a conversation with her about this and maybe update us?
Yeah, I'll certainly. I know she's busy, but I'll call her.
Yeah, as a non-party person, still doing my research and vetting, I just found it to be like, well, you're kidding me. Yeah, and that was just a simple thing. When I heard that, I'm going, what? So anyway, that'd be a very interesting thing. Okay, I'm done. Bring your other person in, Robert, or talk to him, or let him talk, or whatever.
Well, actually, they just put in the chat that they're just listening. But however, if you'd like to chime in, just put in the chat that you want me to reopen your mic. So go ahead, Chris.
Okay, so yeah, I think we've tackled this pretty hard. We know that there's work to do. We know that. From a constitutional standpoint, it's not the federal government's right to come into states and tell states what to do. We know that it's stupid to have the federal government come in and fund elections to make it fair for all. That's just a socialist ridiculousness.
Right.
And we know that it's ridiculous that $100 million apiece to both the RNC and DNC of taxpayers' dollars went to them for their convention. And the other thing that wasn't talked about was the federal matching funds. I mean, what the hell, French, is the federal government spending money so that you can get somebody elected? This is we the people. It's just insanity when I hear this crap. So we know that needs to go.
And Chris Hell's okay. But two things. One, I want to just put out for the folks, the new folks who are out there, that if you'd like to call in and chime in, of course, you can. And to reach us, the call-in number is area code 347-945-7428. So feel free to call in whether you agree or disagree. I welcome both types of callers in here, as long as, I said earlier, just be respectful. And two, Chris, you mentioned about Goud having, you know, $200 maximum per vote. But if you have 1 million people give the $200, that's $200 million right there.
Oh, let's become politicians.
I'm sorry?
I said, let's become politicians. That's a pretty good matrix.
Well, there was a time in my life when I considered being a politician, but what the poor families of some of these politicians have to go through in order to get there, that's not something, you know. I'm not holding against anyone,
sure,
the politician,
I'm sure,
of course.
I'm sure a portion of that $200 million would solve that. Anyway, I'm being facetious.
You're being facetious, yeah, okay.
I've always said, you know,
well,
you become,
you know,
a politician, or start a religion.
You know, I've been involved in this game for 8 years now, and I had, before I actually got involved, I'm telling you, there was not a moment, not hardly even a twitter of a bone in my body that had any machinations about getting involved in politics. And when people ask me why I got involved in politics and why I'm trying to quote unquote become a politician, it's because I hate politics. I hate what it has become in America, and I'm not really a politician. I'm trying to uphold the standard of what it means to be a statesman, but even there, I'm certainly I struggle. All I can say is what I add to the game is I'm just a pissed off jarhead that wants to take his country back.
Cool. Well, let's roll to the next question, Robert. I think we beat this one to death. I mean, I don't mean that sarcastically. I just think we really covered a lot of stuff here. And they had Balt, you know, they had
just one thing. You mentioned it was the first question on the debate. You know, they skipped the opening statements and straight for the top two issue. The one thing I just want to mention in this is that Jill Stein primarily, and then, of course, Rocky Anderson. They are the two that kept using the word over and over, democracy, 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 democracy. And I was in the middle of the auditorium, and I can't tell you how many times when I heard that word, I almost stood up and yelled, "It's a stinking republic, you idiot!" But I didn't. I kept my seat.
Cool.
You controlled yourself then.
I think I heard Randy a couple times when I was replaying the debate today. So what's what was the next question? Besides their opening statements, I mean, we all, you know, Johnson's pro everything, but he is, you know, he is strong on the economy.
He's everything.
What?
He's pro-choice everything.
Right. He said, "I'm pro-choice everything."
Right.
He's pro-everything, and he's pro-choice everything.
Right. But he seems like a pretty fiscally driven person.
Well,
but what
about the free schools? So did he talk? Did he say something which kind of like, "Whoa, what's this?" When you had Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson talking about, you know, all the free government tuition. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, but it kind of sounded to me that he was on board with that. I mean, wasn't there a spot where he talked about, "Oh, you know, this thing free that"? I mean, maybe he was being sarcastic.
I don't think that was his point, because his point was there is no such thing as free. Free has a cost behind it. That was really his point.
Okay. That's what I was hoping he was saying, because I was screaming that at the TV, like, "What do you mean? There's a free this, free that. I mean, don't you know somebody's got to pay for it?" And I'm like, "Do you not know that, you know, we can't afford this?" That's why when, you know, a lot of times you've heard Virgil, you know, you're not going to like the sound of this, you know, you're not going to like to hear this, but...
I don't think I've ever heard Johnson say anything out of whack in terms of my perceptions of fiscal issues in the country. I think he gets it. I mean, am I wrong, Randy?
No, I didn't hear, in terms of fiscal responsibility, anything I particularly disagreed with. The one thing I would have liked to have heard, you know, because they did talk about the education, and, you know, the one thing that Virgil did...
That's what I was referring to with education. Go ahead, Randy.
Yeah, well, you know, the one thing that I know Virgil stands on is he stands for the fact that one of the ways to bring this country back to fiscal responsibility is to get rid of the unconstitutional departments. And
departments,
the Department
right.
of Education being one of those. And so, you know, that was the one thing that I missed in his answer that I wish he would have really put out there. Is like, look, you know, now he did say, "You know what, son? I'm going to give you the answer that you're not wanting to hear, but guess what? This country can't afford it." And, you know, if he'd have just said and added, "And the way that we could start making it a little bit more affordable is if we destroy and repeal and get rid of the Department of Education and let the money go back to the states where the money can reside there. We're helping you already. Just get the federal government totally out of it."
Yeah. Well, and I think the thing that just observing the debate, the thing that I wish I could be Virgil's debate coach, is taking advantage of the time that he's given and run with it, because you have got to sell yourself to people. And one thing I'm not trying to build up Johnson, don't get me wrong, but when he gets that mic, he runs with it. You know what I'm saying? He takes advantage of that mic. And that's really important, because so many people don't know what we know. You've got to get your message out there. And I know that's difficult, because he's a Southern gentleman with a heavy accent. Even though he wouldn't say he has an accent.
Can I make a good point, Chris? And actually, after the debate, I went over and talked to Virgil, and I said, "Virgil, I have, out of everything, it was awesome. I just have one critique. never not use all of your time. I said, you know, even if you didn't continue down that path about the NDAA, you could have used it to educate, you know, what the Constitution Party's position and why it's so important to understand it. In fact, the one thing I didn't hear discussed about any of it, you know, Jill Stein came probably almost the closest to saying, you know, it violates civil rights. Well, no, it doesn't necessarily violate civil rights per se. It violates the Constitution. The NDAA violates the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, which says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without the due process of the law. It's a complete violation of the Constitution. It doesn't just simply ignore it. It steps on it, tramples it, and violates the Constitution. And that's the one thing that was totally missing out of all of that conversation.
Right. Right.
You know, after that description, I'm feeling pretty sorry for the Constitution. It's been trampled, and what else did you see? There was like, man, a poor Constitution. Yeah, just had a picture, you know, a picture of mine of some just getting trampled, and
you know what?
You know,
well, you know, George Bush said it's nothing more than just a GD piece of paper, right? So,
yeah, it's the people. So the next one, the war on drugs. Virgil could have run with this on securing the border and on illegal immigration. That was I was just going you know, let me run this by you guys. I was breaking this down, and one of the things that I screamed out to my wife, I just found the hole in this war on drugs argument. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm researching it. I'm studying it. I know that we are wasting amazing amounts of money on, you know, in all the arguments. But here's the thing. When Johnson talks about legalizing pot and then quotes the total war on drug dollars in terms of incarcerations and all the spinoff, you know, side effects, here's the thing. They don't break out just the marijuana numbers. If your goal is to promote the legalization of marijuana, then you need to make sure you take the other drugs out of your statistics, because those drugs are a whole different ballywhack. You know what I mean? There's a, you know, when you start talking about meth and you start talking about heroin and
hold the phone. You know, Johnson said he included cocaine into that too. He says, because, you know, if you want to do cocaine, it causes holes in your hearts and it kills you, so you should have the right to do that too. So, you know, I think he included everything.
I got to disagree with that because I transcribed it, but I think he was just trying to make a different point. You know, when he was talking about, he was trying to make a point, and he didn't have enough time to make it in. But we could go back to that and re-listen to that. I'm not going to argue that point. That was the last thing I was transcribing. But
one of the topics I like, because we're on the topic of marijuana, but one of the topics that they did bring up, which actually is one of my, you know, pet projects, so to speak, or something I'm real passionate about. I've done projects on things of that research, is industrialized hemp. I think it's ridiculous that, you know, it's illegal in the United States to grow industrialized hemp. And now, I'm not saying legalize marijuana, but, you know, the reason it is illegal is because they put industrialized hemp in the same family as marijuana. And, I mean, you could smoke a whole stalk, a whole plant of industrialized hemp, and you wouldn't get anything from it. So that's just lobbyists, you know, like the lumber industry lobbyists that, you know, it's one reason why that remains illegal. I think it's, you know, incredibly stupid. I mean, you've got some of your states who one of their main cash crops is tobacco. And, you know, while, you know, and they're losing money because, you know, people, which is good, aren't smoking as much, but then they're losing all this revenue from, you know, from that cash crop of being tobacco. Well, they could replace that cash crop, you know, from tobacco and move over to industrialized hemp, and that can actually be a staple, you know, for them. So
yeah,
I mean, there's just so many things you can make with industrialized hemp, though. I mean, really.
No, but I don't
I mean,
think hemp, industrialized hemp is the war on drugs. I think that's a I think that's an issue of competitors.
Well, I agree, but they lump. That's what I was saying earlier, though, Chris, is that they lump industrialized hemp in the same category as marijuana, and that's why they keep it illegal. You know, and that's why they. I'm just saying this subject was brought up. You know, I'm not saying totally per se as with the war on drugs, but since they do lump industrialized hemp in the same family, in the same category as marijuana, that's the mode in which they use to keep industrialized hemp illegal.
Great. Well, that's just more of our crooked politicians then.
By the way, before we get off of the war on drugs, y'all aware that the NDAA has a major section within it that finances the war on drugs.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's through the national – remember, this is the National Defense Authorization Act that deals with, you know, our military. And, you know, what I've always found really bizarre about this is they've got this big thing that they're authorizing all of this money for the war on drugs, and that apparently that they can use the military in this. And here it is. We've, invaded – Afghanistan, who prior to this invasion was only able to supply about somewhere between 7-8% of all the heroin that came into the United States, and now because of our occupation, they're able to supply about somewhere between 80-90% of all the heroin that comes in. Now, here it is. We are the occupational force. We've got this war on drugs in the NDAA, and it's worse now that we're there by 10 times worse than it is by us being there than, you know, anything that we're supposed to, you know, you'd have thought if we really had this war on drugs, that 8% would have been reduced to like 1.
You know what? I want to get your sheriff that's running down in Florida for Marion County on, because he's, you know, that guy has a rough background. You know, he was pardoned. You know, I mean, he's an amazing guy. And he also runs facilities, you know, what I call halfway houses from my day and age. But, you know, facilities, you know, 200-bed facilities for people that are transitioning in and out of prison. This guy knows this stuff. And he's also one of the people, he also believes that, I actually listened to Judge Gray on this. And he was talking about, even Johnson threw it out there, you know, the numbers of people that are incarcerated, 1.8 million people a year arrested on, you know, now I don't know what part of that is the pot, because that's where you have to get the numbers and break them out. Because there's people in the Libertarian Party want it all legalized, but Johnson is only taking the position on the marijuana. But this guy, there's a bunch of sheriffs and judges and people in the legal system that are going, this is crushing our system. The nonviolent recreational use of drugs is crushing our system, and people are carrying these, you know, it's they're carrying it their whole lives, you know, and I've actually heard the numbers of 860,000 people a year arrested for pot, you know what I mean, and not for selling it, you know, for possession, and it's just huge. And so having, you know, I grew up I was a 70s teenager, so I was a young adult in the 80s in Alaska, so trust me, I've got my own personal past and background. And so, you know, I look at the impact of this stuff on people's lives, the cost in the system, and I really want to get into this, and I want to get some people on who are pro decriminalization. I don't know if there's a difference between legalizing and decriminalization, like reducing it.
Well, I think that was Virgil Goode's point, Chris. I think that really was his point. I think, you know, there's a difference between the federal government saying, okay, we're going to make a law and legalize it. Besides, you know, Virgil says, I'm for getting rid of this war on drugs. It's a big waste and drain on our system. But, you know, if the states want to legalize it, that's a state issue. It's not a federal issue. And I think, you know, that was where he came from.
Well, I think that's where he needs to get better at articulating that stuff quicker. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to criticize. I don't want to be disrespectful for him. But go ahead.
No, gentlemen, I believe I have Harriet here on the line. You'd like to chime in. It's a little bit off topic, but she did ask if she could come in and ask about something, and I told her that if she had something to chime in about, to go ahead and let me know, and here she is. Harriet?
Oh, yeah. Hi, everyone.
Thank you.
I'm trying to report a little bit on my research for marijuana, just for education. I was quite impressed.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, Harriet. I thought it was just about sheriffs, but I guess it's about as well. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say while I'm writing these notes. Okay. Now, I attended our tea party on Monday, and I met both of the sheriffs that are running for sheriff office in Marion County. And I met DeCastro, and I met the other, Sheriff Blair. They're both conservatives. And DeCastro does have a background, and he did explain it. He did write it, and he was from 1977 to 1984 incarcerated, and then he came out, and the sentencing and everything was dropped by, I think, then Governor Childs. And since then, he has done very well in Marion County with the work farm. And the work farm, incidentally, is located not too very far from where I live. But they grow vegetables, and they have animals, and the workers really, really, really get a good education. They're outside, they're working, and they get good pay. And they are doing this in the last six months to 12 months of their sentence. And I believe Sheriff DeCastro has started that program, and it's working very, very well in our county. I met both the sheriffs, and I am impressed. And I think I'm going to go with DeCastro.
I love the guy. I mean, we just hit it off. We started talking. I have a past, not a fraction of what his is, but you know, we had that common relatability, and and we just, you know, I get it. I worked 3 years in drug rehab, you know, and taught classes and you know, all this stuff. They actually believe it or not, they wanted me to be a counselor, but that was when the government came in and all the psychologists, and they wanted to start labeling everything as a disease. And I was old school, you know, go to AA, get your crap cleaned out, quit feeling sorry for yourself, make your amends, you know, ask for forgiveness, you know, basic Christian principles, because AA is right out of the Bible. And they wanted to turn everybody into a case and start labeling all these diseases. And then that was the era that all the drugs started coming into our rehab, you know, the federal government drugs and all those kind of crap. I mean, you want to talk about a war on drugs? Get rid of that crap. If you want society to get its head together, quit having legal behavioral drugs handed out by doctors 24/7.
Another thing with that, Chris, is that if you label it as a disease, and in some, if not many, instances, you could take this personal responsibility away from that. And so once you take the personal responsibility, you know, away, then, well, now they're dependent on something or someone. And I think part and parcel is one of the reasons why they want to just label everything with a disease is to take the personal responsibility away from folks, because once you take away personal responsibility away from someone, then it develops a reliance on someone else or something else, and that, of course, goes to, you know, possibly like the government, or, you know, for them to supply you with, you know, whatever, you know, medicines or whatever that you're supposed to, you know, take because of, you know, this disease they're trying to fix.
I have a series. Go on. I'm sorry, Harriet.
The governor here in Florida has done a very good thing, and it's working. The pain control clinics where they can go in and get medication alias for back pain or whatever they have, he's cut down on a lot of them. He's made a lot of arrests, and he's really cleaned up that system.
I remember. Do you remember the whole "Just Say No" Nancy Reagan and the war against cocaine, and then all the DEA agents and, you know, that got involved in the dealing, and then the whole Vietnam era. I don't trust government to manage anything. I don't. And Dr. Paul, and not to, you know, sidetrack here, but Dr. Paul has been against the forced testing and drugs and behavioral drugs in our society forever. I have a series of stuff I haven't even posted yet and some research that I found because I want to get through the election first. But, you know, everybody's got their pet issues. This is a huge issue for me. I've sat down with friends of mine whose kids got in trouble with the law over some stupid kid prank. Next thing you know, they were supposed to be in some facility. Next thing you know, they labeled them with something. Next thing you know, they got them on some behavioral drug. And I have friends whose children have never been the same because of this crap, just because they got caught up in the legal system over some stupid thing they did with a kid, you know, like some robbery thing or, you know, stole something, stupid crap. And they turned them into zombies with this crap. And don't even get me started. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I can write a couple books too on my experiences in working it with this with patients. It's and seeing babies born in withdrawal, babies born malformed. I mean, it is, and mothers not getting prenatal care, and all they have to do is go to the health department, no questions asked, and they register and get the prenatal care, and they're filling up with drugs. And when these babies are born, it is so pitiful. We take them up to the NICU unit, and they survive, and they don't. Then before you know it, 9 months later, the mother's back having another baby. And that just keeps everybody going round and round and round.
It's huge money.
Yes, it is.
And it's so wrong. It's so wrong. And like I say, I've been through rehab. You know, that just gives you a foot, you know, a little. At 28 years old, they rolled me into one in a wheelchair because I was BTN. I can tell you, I've been there, done that, and I've been on the other side of it. And I haven't drank or drugged since I was 28 years old. I'm 54. You know, I've worked with people, helped people, and this stuff they're doing to our citizens. And this, I mean, I tell people all the time when they get off on this drug war, especially pot. Give me a break.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let me tell you about alcohol. Let me tell you about alcohol destroying people's lives. But what they give people legally every day, the numbers of women walk into it. You know this. You're in the medical. Women walk in and go, ouch, and they get a drug.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Are we off topic?
Maybe a little bit.
Well, we hope that people are listening to this because there's a lesson in this.
I admire you,
Chris, because it's from today on that counts what you do in life, not what you did in the past. But the thing is, I mean, you really, really come out remarkable. You're just wonderful.
No, me? I'm a madman.
It's what you do from now on that counts. Just like DeCastro. Am I going to hold it against him what he did? No. I'm going to vote for him. I think
he's an amazing guy.
He is marvelous. We're not here to judge. We're just here to help.
Harriet, you're an amazing person.
Well, thank you. If I were to go on drugs, and sometimes I wonder, no, I won't, I would go on a good drug, a good narcotic, because I would be able to withdraw from that much quicker, and
just
it would show up in my blood so quickly.
Just remember, reality is for those who cannot do drugs.
Yeah.
Right.
No, yeah, there you go.
That's right.
This is awesome, though. So you guys ready not to cut you off, but are you guys ready to roll on?
I'm ready to roll on.
This is a great conversation, and I want to take this thing, and do some shows and get DeCastro back on, and because he's one of those guys that believes that, you know, we are way, way on the wrong side of, you know, some
and
of these issues
and
the legal drugs.
Yeah, and people there were talking, and nobody was able to say anything against him. And there was a standing ovation. The parking lot, the church was just packed.
That's great.
Just packed to the gills.
I hope he gets elected. He's a great guy.
Well, he got my vote.
Cool. Well, that means a lot because you're pretty powerful. I'm sure people don't have a chance with you when you get up in their face. So anyway, I'm sorry, Harriet.
I can defend myself. Just ask Rex.
Oh, I know it. I've heard you. I've heard you on the shows. I'm glad you called in too. So foreign policy.
Yeah, we'll keep your mic open, Harriet. If you want to chime in, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm quiet for now. Who's next?
Foreign policy.
Well, we did have someone. I offered for them to come in, which I've done this on numerous occasions, especially during the primary. We did have someone in chat who I did invite to call in because she was a Mitt Romney supporter. However, she gracefully declined. I asked why. But unfortunately, she is no longer in the chat. No, I didn't boot her. She voluntarily left. I didn't ask to or anything, just maybe because she realized this wasn't a Mitt Romney supporting show. But it is unfortunate. But if there are any guests out there or anyone else who is a Romney or even an Obama supporter, you're more than welcome to come in and tell us why you think that is the choice we ought to make. And that's a discussion that we should have. We do still have a couple couple weeks left in this
election. Let's hope they do it another night so we can actually
The reason why I offer it, even maybe tonight, Chris, is because, let's be honest, you've been on the show a lot. How often has it been where someone has taken us up on that offer? I've offered it many, many times, and they just don't come in. And I think that, if we have a dialogue with some of the folks and we show them the logic behind supporting third parties instead of the, duopoly, because, we've done the duopoly for so long, and you've heard me say on other shows, if you always do what you've always done, you're always going to get what you already have got, then perhaps, minds and hearts need to be changed, and perhaps if they would stay long enough, in these types of venues and these shows, that perhaps something would sink in, and that's why I invite them on, is perhaps we can open up a dialogue with them in which, we can do that and say, hey, look, this is why third parties aren't only viable options, but, the most logical ones, and also one that people, I think, can walk away feeling more like they voted their conscience.
Yeah, just one comment in that particular arena. I don't disagree with you, Robert, not entirely anyway. But there's a lot of people that, they're going to come in, and the only thing they're going to do is try to espouse their way. They don't actually have an open mind. They don't want to learn. They don't want to know. I've been in this fight for a while, and, when you start talking to people, like, for instance, I'll never forget this one lady who came by the table, and we had a conversation about pro-life. And I didn't beat her up. All I did was ask her a question, and she would make an answer. And I would ask her another question, and I'd say, well, then what about this? And, then what about this? And I just started, every time I was asking her a question, it's like, okay, what's her – then she responds, and it's getting worse and worse and worse to – and I say worse, it's getting worse for her. She's not able to respond to where she actually got to a point. I'm like, okay, so now it's a human being and a life, so why would you abort it? And what her answer was, well, it's just my right, and that's what I believe, and she walked away. After I destroyed all of her reasons behind it. Now, I don't know if maybe, a week, a year, maybe she at some point in time, changed her mind as she let that simmer and soak. But, we've got to look at what's happening in here. And I think when people, come in with an open mind, I've really changed my view, or should I say my tactics. When I first started in this fight, I was there to slay the enemy. I was going to destroy you with the truth. And my wife used to say, Randy, is that really what you want to do? I thought you wanted to sway them over to your position and start building something. I'm like, well, that's what I want to do. She goes, you're not going to do it by killing them. And so, you know, I've really had, and it's still a battle. It, you know, the first thing I want to do, the first, my first response is to take them out. You freaking idiot. But I have to really start, you know, okay, how do I address this to really fight the argument and present the truth in such a way that, in fact, here's an old word that's really cool, whimsical. Where we produce the argument to where it's so whimsical that they want it. And that's one of the fights that I have and an internal struggle for me. So, you know, let's do it. Let's bring them on. But understand there's several different aspects of why people come on board.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And Chris, you're saying something?
Indeed. Indeed.
Indeed. Fascinating.
And without further ado, let's get on to foreign policy.
Let's get on to foreign policy without further ado, yes.
So anyway, foreign policy. No, this is all good stuff, and it's happening a lot on this show, you know. We went over an hour, like three nights in a row, you know, just rolling with stuff, which is great, you know. And I really, really, if we get time, if we don't run out of time, if I open my mouth, Randy's going to explain it, but I really want people, I had a massive argument on my site, and it came up again on this pro-life issue. And I have been learning my constitution and learning from all you guys, and I said, well, yeah, life is, you know, somebody says it's not a federal issue, and I go, that's not correct. What is not a federal issue, the reason that Roe v. Wade worked the way it worked is because they made this point that life started at, you know, viability or whatever their ruling was, and they passed it back to the states. If the judge would have said life starts at conception, you damn right it would have been a federal issue because it's in our first, you know, it's in the Bill of Rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You cannot take somebody, you can't take their life or their property without due process. And I realize that not many people understand that, Randy. You know, that they keep saying it's a state's issue, it's a state's issue. It is a state's issue as it resides now. But the moment that the issue of when life starts is over, it ain't no longer a state's issue because the government's
right.
Going to have to make a ruling on it. Can you explain
and
that?
Well, yeah, certainly.
This is pre-foreign.
Real quick, Randy, before you do, I just want to say for folks who want some very cogent, logical explanation, if they find themselves in a debate with someone on the abortion issue, a great book to get some good material and good argument against abortion is a book called The Case for Life, and it is written by a Scott Klusendorf, and the last name is spelled Klusendorf. I really suggest for any of those who are strongly against abortion and find themselves wanting material to argue against it, I suggest that is a great resource. Thank you, Randy. Go ahead.
No, absolutely. Every bit that where – look, I got to tell you, I have not always been so hardline pro-life. Before my wife, she actually joined the Birthright organization when we were stationed in California. And through that organization, I learned. And then when I joined the Constitution Party, whose very first plank is the sanctity of life, I had to learn a whole bunch more from a political perspective. And this is what we're talking about right here when it comes to the sanctity of life is this political perspective and why the courts have been able to get by with what they've done. And what they've done is what they've always done in the sense that they have taken the liberty to make a definition. And, Chris, you alluded to it, but what they have done is, see, we have to understand, you said correctly, that it is a constitutional issue. What the courts have done is they have said, basically, that a person is not a person until they have escaped the birth canal and come out of there. In fact, you know, this partial birth abortion, people think, oh, it's absolutely horrible. Well, why they have been able to get by with even a partial birth abortion is because the courts have upheld that a human being is not a person until they actually are able to fully escape from the birth canal. And so what I would strongly support is an amendment to our Constitution. I don't support any others. Even though the term limits, I'm not a full supporter of the term limits amendment, but an amendment that takes the definition out of the hands of the courts and define a human being as being a person from conception unto natural death. Then that rips out the court's ability to make that definition. Now, why is that important, and how does that make it relevant to the Constitution? Well, I just mentioned the Fifth Amendment in relationship to the NDAA, but guess what? The Fifth Amendment says no person shall. And there's a couple of phrases in between that one and the one I'm going to say now, but it says, nor shall they be deprived of life, liberty, or property without the due process of the law. So just simply declaring that a human being is a person from conception unto natural death means then that you cannot go in and murder this person without the due process of the law. If there's rape, if there's incest, and if there's other elements, well, then that's for a court to decide, but give the person, this unborn child, the advantage of having the due process of the law and let the courts decide it at that point in time. So when you start understanding this whole system of liberty and how it applies, then you understand how important it is that we uphold our Constitution and rip out of the hands of the courts their ability to make law that is contrary to the Constitution, because certainly our founding fathers never understood it to be any other thing. But here's the real bizarre part, okay? If you, as a man, come and punch a pregnant woman in the belly and cause her unborn child to die, they will charge you for murder. How is that possible? Under this current system?
Well, they try to say, oh, well, it's the intent of the mother to carry the, you know, to continue carrying the child. And we could keep on with this subject, but I do want to let someone in. And there's a new caller, and the area code 410. I'm getting ready to open your mic. If you just give us your name and, for my curiosity, your location, and tell us what's on your mind, and then we will continue on with the current topic. So 410, you are at Mike's live.
Hey, it's Chris from the county state of Maryland. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for calling in.
I'm just saying, I just checked in. Now, this is the first time I'm listening to this show. I did want to comment. I heard a lot of what you just said. First and foremost, anybody in any country has never survived with killing the most innocent among them. And the Constitution, as far as, you know, rape and incest, I understand all that stuff, but, you know, abortion is way beyond everything. Unfortunately, I've gone through some of that situation myself, you know, and I stood and tried to fight against it, and I can't tell you how humiliated I was sitting in front of a courtroom with certain people laughing at me. But the precious, you know, life is undeniable. And I think that's what the Constitution strives to protect. And if we don't protect the most precious among us, the most innocent, then, you know, we're going to see more of what we're having already.
Well, we've often said it here. If you can't get it right on the life issue, how can I trust you to get it right on anything else? The single most important right that a human being has is the right to life. And if you can't get it right, I'm supposed to trust you on something else?
Hey, I got a question for you. Now, in this argument that was going on my site, somebody said, well, murder is not a federal issue. You want to cover that one?
Well, actually, it is. Because anytime you kill somebody without the due process of the law, it is murder. Now, we've primarily, though, we got to understand that murder is prosecuted at the state level. We understand that, and that's not a mystery. But the point is that, you know, it is prosecuted, but it is the right to life is a federal issue. And that the Constitution, I think, makes it clear that the federal government cannot come in and take your life without the due process of the law. And I think it stands to reason, and that's why it's important to understand that the Constitution was the document to control, put the chains on this union of states. It was never meant to be the control of all the states' citizens. But the founding fathers said, you know what? In fact, it was because of the anti-federalists that the Bill of Rights got put into the Constitution, because they said, look, we have seen centrally controlled governments usurp power that there is not theirs. And so if you get this government, we want to have certain guarantees that this federal government is not going to infringe on these rights. Now, remember, and to demonstrate the point here, take a look at the First Amendment. The First Amendment says the federal government cannot do what? Make law regarding the establishment of a religion. What you have to understand, exactly at this time when this document, the Constitution, was ratified, there were actually state-sanctioned religions. Okay? Yep. This document did not say you cannot have a state religion. It said the federal government cannot do that. And so we've got to be clear on the jurisdiction upon which this document applies. It's why I got involved in the Constitution Party, because I watched, this is where it got to me, I watched the federal government infringe on states' rights issue as it regarded the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Alabama, Roy Moore, who said, I must acknowledge God in my job. And all it was there was a Ten Commandments monument that the federal government says you got to remove from the courts. Roy Moore says, no, this is a state issue. Back off. Well, what happened? The federal government inserted their business into a state issue. So not only did they violate the First Amendment, which says not only can they not make a law regarding the establishment of a religion, but it further goes on, nor the infringement of the free exercise thereof. And so when we take a look at that and understand how this document specifically applies, and I think this was the point that Virgil Goode made pretty good last night, was that there are things that are for the states and there are things that are supposed to be prohibited from the government from according to the Constitution. If it's not in the Constitution, where does it go? To the states. And that's where we really have to understand how all this stuff applies.
Great. But if a state, let's take it to a simple concept. If a state got up and said, well, we're not going to prosecute murder anymore, the federal government would come down on them like a ton of bricks, because it is a federal issue.
Well, that's right. The protection of life is a federal issue because of the Bill of Rights. And so if they start violating this covenant, this agreement, all these 50 states that join this union says we will abide by this Constitution. And what's the 9th and the 10th Amendment say? You know, the 10th Amendment says if it's not in this Constitution, it's reserved for the states. So they're supposed to take advantage of that, not only advantage, but responsibility for it.
Beautiful. Okay, you guys ready for foreign? Where were we at?
Yeah. Foreign, it was foreign. We were going to get to foreign policy, but I'd like to thank the caller for coming in. Hopefully, I believe you're still listening. I don't see you in the studio anymore. Not studio, but in the switchboard anymore. But thank you very much for calling in tonight. Go ahead, guys. Yes, foreign policy. Let's get to foreign policy.
Well, the thing, and I've studied. I think that Johnson, from what I've heard and watched videos of his off and on, and I've seen a lot of stuff that's been posted on the Ron Paul sites that are not pro Johnson at all. You know, and I think that what he has been doing over, I don't know, since he's become the Libertarian president is refining his foreign policy speak. But as it stood last night and also what I'm hearing him say now, he's pretty much, him and Virgil could get up and shake hands and agree on just about everything that they were talking about, that we're,
right.
You know, we got to quit doing these illegal wars. We got to quit, you know, the drone. He's really good at buzzing the crowd.
You know,
there he is.
There's two things I want to mention, and in that opening statement, one of the things that Gary Johnson said, and was it his opening comments? I think maybe it was, or I don't remember. But one of the things he said is, "I became a Republican, and I was the only anti-establishment candidate out there." I'm like, really? You join the Republican Party, and you are the only person to attack it from the outside. You know, I can't tell you how many times I have heard that rhetoric over and over again. I'm like, yeah, no, I don't buy that. But anyway, be that as it may, the other thing I want to touch on is, you know,
the whole issue
of the drone. You know, one of the things, you know, the drone has become a buzzword. The drone. You know, Listen. You know, one of the things they said, I stand against the drone taking out innocent citizens or, you know, innocent people. I'm like, guess what? We've got bombers that drop bombs from miles high that do that. We got Marines, Army, Air Force that are on the ground that do that. You know what? It's not a drone issue. It is a constitutional issue. You know, they're going to use the military against us to surveil us. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's a drone or if it's the SWAT team that comes and knocks your door down and carts you off and you never heard or seen from again. It doesn't matter if it's a drone. In fact, I'm actually quite for a drone. I'd prefer a drone to go into battle than us to lose American citizens. I
have to agree with that. I'm glad you said that, Randy. I really am, because when they were talking about drones, I have to admit, they're so up against drones. I have to agree with that. I'd rather have someone sitting in the safety of a building somewhere, you know, using a joystick or whatever control pad, as you said, than to have boots on the ground and putting our men and women in uniform in danger. The more automated it can get, of course, we want the technology to get even better, where, you know, collateral damage, and it's terrible, if not there, have it be more focused. But yeah, I mean, I'd rather have a machine be able to go in there than
Terminator.
So
I
want
Terminator.
The point is, you took my thunder, Chris. I was going to mention Terminator. Thanks a lot, man. No. That would be cool, though. Go ahead, guys.
But, you know, it really comes down to the unconstitutional use of this technology. You know, it's like, why are we opposed to the traffic cams and all these other things? It's because of the invasion of property. It's not that we're opposed to the technology behind it. You know, there's some good applications of it. But when it starts violating the Constitution and our constitutionally guaranteed rights, then I'm against it, and I don't care if it's a drone or if it's a freaking idiot that wants to come stomp my door down, I'm going to put you out.
You know what? That was a great – you opened my mind on that, because we're all susceptible to focus marketing, you know, and that's really good. That I'm glad that we finally got to foreign whatever we're on, foreign policy.
And foreign policy can't continue, but I do see that it is 11 minutes and counting till the
2 hours.
To the end of the live portion of the show. So if anyone would like to stay on in the conversation, feel free to call in at area code 347-945-7428, and we can continue the discussion in the recording session, which will last an hour. So if you'd like to do that, I would suggest calling in within the next 10 minutes so you can participate. It is recorded, so it will be on the archives. So feel free and do so if you'd like. Go ahead, Chris and Randy.
So, but back to what I was saying before Randy did his excellent insight into the drone conversation. But for the most part, I'd say these guys are pretty right on. The question I have is, I know Virgil Good because I've interviewed the guy, and I've interviewed your vice president, and I've interviewed, you know, a bunch of, or Robert and I have, you know, a bunch of your people. And I know that when they get in there, they'll do something about it. And that's something that I really, truly believe. And I've told my Johnson friends, I said, you know, I don't know yet. Be honest with you, I don't know the guy. I hear a lot of things he's saying. I've seen some shifts in policies, and maybe not. And we're not going to know where he really stands until after the election, because my question is, And Randy, I've asked you this question: is he going to stick around after the election? You know, is he going to stay and build the party? Is this just an opportune time to get your face in the news and get some publicity and get some political capital built up, or is it really because you really believe in what the party stands for and that kind of thing? So,
well, here's my insight to that particular answer, and this is one of the reasons why in the beginning part of the show I mentioned that, you know, I've known Virgil Good for 3 years now, and, you know, I considered him a friend, but it has only been within the last 6 months that I have actually got a deeper appreciation and a deeper respect for who Virgil is, because here's the thing, okay? In fact, I approached Virgil kind of sloughed off the answer, and I'm still going to nail him on this again because I really want to know. He's been a member of the party. Right now, the Constitution Party is probably at its lowest strength that it's been in about 10 years. I think it grew up to about 2004. It was probably at its pinnacle about then, and because of some issues that happened to rock the party, we're kind of at our low point right at the moment. And the fact is that Virgil's been a member of the executive committee of the Constitution Party for at least 2 years, I think. And so he's had some inside perspective of what's going on with this party. Now, knowing, for me personally, okay, knowing the condition of our national strength right now, I would not have been overly inclined to want to run for president right now. I would have let some other yahoo run and see if we can't get the party built up to a significant structure to where I could actually see myself winning the election in 4 years. But here's what happens. Virgil, who has been a member of the executive committee for the past, you know, at least couple years, knowing the condition of this party, you know, what its structural condition is right at this point, its financial conditions is right at this point, decided to make a run. Now, Virgil certainly had a war chest left over from his congressional races. What he has done is he has invested that money to help states get on the ballot. Now, understand that helping states get on the ballot is not his job. His job is to run a presidential campaign. It is the state parties, the national parties, responsibility for ballot access, to have ballot access that our candidates can actually get on. It's not the candidate's responsibility for quote-unquote ballot access. It's right. The state's, the national. But Virgil has taken that money, and instead of just saying, you know what, I'm just going to use this money to campaign on, Virgil has invested that money in party structure. Now, this is the only thing, I won't say the only, but this is probably the single most important, significant point here to make me believe that Virgil's not in it just to see for his own selfish ends, and that it gives me hope that he will be sticking around. You know, he was in my during the primaries, and I say during the primaries, but it was up. We don't, for the most part, most of our parties don't hold primaries. A few of them do, but up to where we held our national convention in April, I held 6 or 7. Presidential debates, and by using Blog Talk, as a matter of fact, and I had 6 presidential candidates involved in those debates, and Virgil was a part of that. And during that point, though, I can't tell you how many times I said, look, this is my debate, it's not the party's debate, I'm holding this debate, and I'm telling you that if I ever find out that you are just here to be a carpetbagger, meaning you're like Alan Keyes did to the party in 2008. He never joined the party. He just came on to run for president, like Tom Tancredo did in Colorado, just came and used the party, and then he's gone. They're carpetbaggers. I cannot stand carpetbaggers, and I will take it a personal affront if you tell me that you are going to be here for the party, even if you don't get elected. I said, because you're making a personal promise to me personally that this is what you're about. And you know my vehemence against being a carpetbagger. And Virgil heard that time and time again. And every time he says, I'm here for the long haul. So I'm willing to take his word. But, you know, certainly at the end of the day, we'll see, you know, how much that means. But right now, Virgil has my confidence that he's here for the long haul.
Cool. Let me ask you this question.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Because let me tell you,
he's
a good guy. He was really down there. I was really impressed with him today. Go ahead, Chris.
No, that's all right. Here's the question I want to ask. I look at you guys as foreign policy, which, you know, like I say, we've interviewed ad nauseum. Okay, so I get it. We're talking, and I also get that they talk about withdrawal of troops and bases, but, you know, that you have to go in and you have to look at treaties and you have to do it responsibly. I get that. But how does a president walk in the door with all these rhinos and Democrats and all these neocons and actually get that done against the battles that he's going to fight? Because the industrial war machine is a multi-trillion dollar game. So
right.
There's obviously going to be a battle there.
Oh, absolutely.
You got five minutes to answer this.
Yeah, well, the 30-second answer is the fact that most likely what's going to happen is, because we know we're facing a two-party duopoly, if we don't have a lot of people in there to support, you know, this constitutional position, quite frankly, the two-party duopoly will probably make him basically a lame duck president. But, you know, on the other hand, though, that's really not a bad thing for America. You know, the Constitution was to be a limiting document, not enabling document. It was a limiting document, and the more we can limit the things that this American government can do, the better off Americans are going to be. So, you know.
Right.
So we got to take a look at reality here. If he was to actually win this presidency, you know, here's some factors. But I also believe that there are still some people that run. I think there were some good candidates in 2010 that thought that they were going to be the one to stand apart and never cave into all this. And then once they get into the two-party duopoly, you know, they're encased in the system. And but when you get people that said, you know what? Here's a president that will enable me to do what I got elected to do. I can finally do it. You know, I think that would be an encouraging part about that.
And let me chime in real quick, gentlemen, because there's only about a little more than 2 minutes left of the live show. Is once again, if anyone would like to call in for the extended edition of Bard's Logic, so you can hear or listen or chime in as well. You can call in at area code 347-945-7428. And I want to thank everyone for coming in tonight, regardless of which one you went, why you came in here, whether it's from Blog Talk Radio or the Bard's Logic Political Talk website, which would be great if you guys go ahead and take a visit there, send me a message from the contact page, look at some of the videos I have on there, some of the guests, and links to archive shows and articles that I have written. And also, if you've listened to all the archives, stay tuned for more. As I said, it can go on for another hour. So take care, everyone. Good night, and hope to see you again. And we have a little more than 2 minutes of live show. So if you were going to call in, I suggest soon. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Let me ask you this, Randy. So let's say in this current climate, somebody like Virgil Goode, who has this really strong, you know, which is what I call the Ron Paul, you know, a very close to a Ron Paul foreign policy. I believe that he has a little bit more, I don't know, I just heard it, maybe I haven't interviewed Ron Paul, but when I hear the details of it, I see a responsible pulling out, you know, of the, you know, I talked about that before. But the president is the commander-in-chief. They could stop any foreign involvements that are
combat situations, correct?
Well, remember that, the, you know, if you look at Article 1, Section 8, and what the power of Congress is, they are the power of the purse. They are the power of to discipline, to regulate, to arm the military. And, you know, and here's another interesting thing. You call them the commander-in-chief. What makes the president the commander-in-chief, by the way?
Beats me.
How about a declaration of war? Because there truly is no other than, now there is a constitutionally standing military, and it is the Navy, and he would be justly considered to be the commander-in-chief over the Navy. But, you know, outside that, there was no standing army, per se. He wasn't a, so, you know, when we talk about what it means to have the authority of the commander-in-chief, we have to understand what the Constitution really says about that authority and what implants that authority on him and when. And so here's the thing, you know, here's a question I got for you. Let's see if you guys can answer this. You know, the according to Article 1, Section 8, one of the mandated responsibilities or duties of Congress is to declare war. Now, if Congress is mandated with this authority to declare war, wouldn't it stand to reason that they never give up that authority over that issue of war? So wouldn't it stand to reason that Congress still retains the a power to undeclare war? And if that's true, what is the constitutional principle to undeclare war?
Why don't they exercise that power?
Real quick, Chris, before you give the answer, and we just started recording time, I'd like to open up the mic of someone many of us know well. And, oh, I'm getting an echo, so I'm going to get on speakerphone.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I hear myself. But anyway, without further ado, I will bring in one of the hosts of the Tex and Rex show, and I believe I have Rex here on the line. Rex, I'm opening up your mic. Thank you very much for calling in.
Hey, Robert.
Hello.
Good. I'm employing a new headset. I thought what Randy said was just very, very powerful, and I think this is probably more important than the Liberty Movement, the Constitution Party, Ron Paul, Virgil Goode, or Gary Johnson, and that is that we have rules, we have the Constitution, and it is still valid despite what some people think happened in 1871, because even if they incorporated the United States or whatever, the Constitution was never repealed.
Right.
Therefore, it's still the law of the land, and does Congress have the right to abdicate their power? No, they do not. They do not have that power unless it is exercised by Article 5. If the Constitution is properly amended to change the powers of the government, then maybe they can do that. But the fact is that they set a massive precedent for transferring power when they gave up the power to regulate the value of coin with the so-called Federal Reserve Act. And because they gave up the power of the purse, they also essentially and effectively gave up the power of the war power. So the fact is that as long as the money is flowing, the money will dictate what actually happens, and the law is irrelevant. And so what we need to do is understand those rules and hold our elected idiots to those rules. And I call them elected idiots because, frankly, even if it's an intelligent man, he's essentially an idiot unless he understands the fact that he is our servant.
Right.
And that's what I think these people don't understand. They somehow think they have power over us. They do not have power over us. We have power over them. They are our servants, which is precisely why I think Virgil Goode is calling for term limits, and Gary Johnson apparently echoed him yesterday. But the idea is that when you go to serve as president, congressman, senator, delegate, or whatever, you are actually serving the constituents who put you in that power by giving you some of their sovereign power. And until we understand that paradigm, we're almost kind of tinkering around the edges because the core is so rotten that we can have all these discussions about should you declare war and should you go into this country and should you do that and should you do this. But if the core is rotten, then it becomes nothing more than a pragmatic calculation, a power play, and always, always, always a funding issue.
Yep. In fact, I've made the case on many times. You know, I ask, okay, why does Congress have the ability to give billions of dollars to other countries? Nothing in the Constitution allows it. So why can they? And I said, well, they can because guess what? They have the money. Why do we have an unconstitutionally standing army since World War II? Well, guess what? They've got the money and they can afford to do it. Why do they fund Planned Parenthood against most of our moral conscience? Well, because they got the money and they can do it. And until you understand that they've got the money and they can do it, and we eliminate that ability to have the money, then we're, you know, money trumps the Constitution. That's what people don't understand. It's what they don't understand, the importance of what happened in 1913 and the ability for the bankers to trump the Constitution. It's the power of the purse, the power of the money.
How in the heck did they pull this off?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, I honestly don't fully understand how they pulled it off, but I do know that on his deathbed, apparently, that Wilson recanted and said, I wish I'd have never done it. I probably destroyed my country.
He did. He did say that. And the fact is that, look, they picked Wilson because Wilson was an academic. So he was relatively easy to persuade with academic arguments because he didn't really understand practical issues, which is what made him such a terrible president. It's not necessarily that he was such a terrible person, but it's just that he was a tool and he didn't even know it. And once they showed him the inside of the honeycomb, he knew how bad it was, but he didn't have the courage to say anything about it until his deathbed. JFK had the courage to say something about it, and look what happened to him. So, you know, Jackson did the same thing. And there were two assassination attempts on Jackson's life. He survived, and he beat the bank. So how it happened, it's very simple. It was, first of all, you know, conspiracy theory. Well, it's not a theory. It's an actual conspiracy. They conspired in secret at Jekyll Island, Georgia, November 22nd, 1910, and that's when the Aldrich Bill, which was drafted by a German national, Paul Warburg, was put forward, and they decided to name this new, quote, bank Federal Reserve System in order to give it the appearance of being a part of the government. And it's just an illusion. So the whole thing was a scam from the beginning. And then once the bill got through, first of all, it wasn't getting through under Aldrich because he was known to be connected with Wall Street. But then it was, you know, as they do with other unpopular bills, they just kind of erase the number, you know, another bill, put a new number on it, and put it back through under a different name. And then all the Wall Street bankers came out and spoke against the bill publicly. It was a propaganda campaign. They were railing against it. And the people who at that time distrusted lawyers and bankers said, mm-hmm. if the Wall Street bankers don't like this bill, then it must be good for us. So then it was put forward that way. And it was put forward as a banking reform bill. And what it ended up doing was creating an illegal cartel that has effectively suspended constitutional government as soon as it came online. Now, they're not so stupid as to do it all at once because they knew that would engender resistance, so they've done it slowly over the last century. And we have just been gobbling it up and fighting with each other and tinkering around the edges. Instead of actually killing this beast, and until you get rid of the Federal Reserve and get rid of all of those men who are on the take from the corrupt interests, you will not restore the government. So again, what we have to realize is that the states have the power. They just don't have the balls.
Let me ask you this. So when they create a new amendment, it has to pass House, Senate, be signed by the president, then it has to be ratified by the states. Is that correct?
That's one way to do it. There is another way to amend it, and that is that the two-thirds of the states can force Congress to accept the amendment.
No, but I'm saying when they gave us the 15th and 16th, they did it from the government top down in that environment.
For which law are we talking about?
Well, like the Federal Reserve, when they put it in place, it was the states bringing it to the government. The government did all their thing and then took it to the states.
There was no amendment. There was no amendment for the Federal Reserve. That was just a bill. The amendment was the amendment that they passed. Were actually passed two amendments following the Federal Reserve.
Tax.
One
no,
being
actually,
the 16th,
it was the,
and the other one being the 17th.
Well, actually, the 16th was in April. No, let's see, February. Then the 17th was in April, and the Federal Reserve Act was passed in October of that year. So it was 16, 17, and then Federal Reserve.
Well, yeah, but again, it was all part of those three are of a piece, and it was in 1910 that they hatched the scheme. So the order of how they were actually passed, but the fact is that they needed the two amendments in place in order to make the legislative action of the Federal Reserve work, because without the 16th and 17th, there'd be no point. Number one, if the Senate was not popularly elected but elected by the state sovereignty would have been able to override the central bank. And number two, without the and it still doesn't even really give them this power. It's just something they've taken. The 16th Amendment allowing our property to be confiscated to pay the interest on the newly fabricated debt, then what would be the point of having a central bank? I mean, the whole point is to fabricate money out of nothing and have people pay you interest and confiscate wealth. And that's what they've done for 100 years.
Yep.
Anybody that doesn't get this or dismisses it as some kind of wacky conspiracy or fringe movement is absolutely, in essence, by default and ignorance, an enemy of the United States.
Absolutely.
So does anybody – maybe I'm asking too many details. Do you know what it passed by in terms of the split?
The banking bill?
Yeah. Was it an overwhelming or was it a tight?
Well, I mean, there were a few who spoke out against it, predominantly like, you know, William Brian Jennings, I think. It was actually, believe it or not, at the time, it was the Democrats who were for sound money and it was the Republicans who were for fiat money. That's how convoluted everything is. But I don't know the specific numbers of how it was passed.
No, if we're talking about the actual 16th and 17th Amendments, all you got to do is go over to D.V. Kidd, and she's got the evidence that reflects that they were never appropriately ratified. There was never enough states to actually make that ratification. So, you know, she talks about that all we have to do is basically simply ignore it because they are not properly ratified amendments.
Yep, and that's precisely why we call the war for Southern independence, the Civil War, in order to forego that little issue of the fact that if the states were not part of the Union, then and they didn't vote for it, you know, that's how they got the 13th and 14th through, and then from there they were able to pass these others. And if there wasn't a 13th and 14th passed as written, it would have been much harder to pass the 16th and 17th. So it's all of a piece, and it's the fact that this corruption has been going on since before the founding of the Republic and actually before the War for Independence. And I think that's what people don't seem to understand, because they think that once a man dies, his corruption goes away. Well, if he has successors, it does not. And that's really what people really have to start understanding, that this has been going on for a long time, because the United States is the exception, not the rule of governance in civilized history.
And the bankers were there for a long time.
No, they started with the Constitution. I mean, they started before, but I mean, look at the discussion over the Constitution. I mean, you had basically the Jeffersonian view espoused also by Madison, and the Hamiltonian view, which was espoused by a foreigner, which is precisely why Article 2 says that only a natural-born citizen can be president, because they didn't want Hamilton wielding that power, because he was. He was a royalist, he was a statist, and he was a tool of the bankers. And so that's basically – you can say that the entire history of the United States can be brought down to the argument between Jeffersonian democratic republicanism and Hamiltonian, quote, republicanism.
Federalism.
Yep.
So, wow. Wow. Wow.
By the way, I got that number for you, Chris. The Federal Reserve Act passed – 298 yeas, 60 nays, and 76 not voting. And then in the Senate, it was 43-25 with 27 not voting. So it was overwhelming. And it was bipartisan.
Unbelievable. Well, I know that in my research that a couple years before there was a big hiccup in the economy, and Chase came in, was one or two of his other banks that ended up being part of the Federal Reserve and bailed everybody out to prevent a crash. And then right after that, they went sling, sling, sling and moved right into the Federal Reserve. And I was reading some stuff that said that a lot of people believe Chase actually caused that to happen, so they could create this environment to scare the hell out of everybody, and then basically get everybody to sign on. You know, I think they were still suffering some of the economics of the Civil War coming in, you know, because that wasn't that long before, you know, economics. Interesting stuff. Wow. Dee, would I have Robert fall asleep?
No, Robert did not fall asleep. You know, I was doing a little research, and actually I'm attempting to look to see what I'm going to have for dinner.
Oh. So basically, nobody without Congress, because, I mean, like I was saying before, that, you know, like if Goode got elected and he was sitting there on that chair, him and Mr. Clymer, with this hostile environment of neocons and crooks and bought-off people and the Fed and all that power, that it would be very difficult to get some of these ideals accomplished. What could they get done? I know that they can veto budget until they hand them a budget that they want. There's, you know, I mean, that, I guess I'm kind of looking for that what could be done conversation.
Well, a lot can be done. I mean, the president does have significant power, especially now. There's a lot of power in that executive. Whether a constitutional president would want to wield that power or not is a different matter. And I'm sure Randy can speak a little bit to that, although I know he doesn't speak directly for Mr. Goode. But I think that the important thing for all of us to understand is no one man, and not even a group of men, are going to be able to repair 100 years of damage ever, and certainly not in one election cycle. It is always, always, always about the will of the people. If we're lazy, if we're looking for free crap, if we're looking for security over liberty, if we fall for all the lies and propaganda, and we allow the corporatists to not only manage our food and our health care and our minds, but our very votes, then, you know, there isn't a single person, there isn't a Ron Paul or a Virgil Goode or anybody who can do anything. It requires an effort on all fronts, which means that we have to be active in our local governments, in our state governments, and we have to put men of good moral character who at least firmly believe in their oath to defend the Constitution. And that's going to require several election cycles and a lot of education and probably a shitload more pain than any of us are really willing to experience.
And the most difficult thing we got to undertake here is that educational aspect, because we don't have an electorate that really wants to be all that educated. They don't mind having stuff force-fed and shoved down their throat. I mean, it's obviously evident of that. And so, you know, the biggest thing to try to do, and I think that's one of the things that's happening with the, as I had mentioned to Chris earlier and to Robert, was you know, it was phenomenal, the number of people that were present in that auditorium. I have never seen more third-party people congregated in one place than I did at that one particular event ever. I've not heard of any other one that had this many people congregated. And I think, you know, one of the things that's happened with Romney and Obama, they've actually created a hunger. And until people start having a hunger for this knowledge and a hunger for something else other than what they've been fed, you know, it's going to be, you know, like trying to make a horse drink. You know, you can shove his face down in the water, but if he doesn't want to drink, all he's going to do is drown. And so, you know, we've got to somehow figure out how to get people to hunger for this knowledge and to understand the circumstances that we are in. You know, who was it that said the pen is mightier than the sword? Well, while that might be true, if people really want to know and understand.
That's the Joker on Batman.
There you go.
God. Well, here is a thought for everybody just standing here brainstorming on this. One of the things that has given me a draw to all this beyond the who should I vote for third party guy is the Constitution. Because I see everybody differently now. When Johnson was talking, when Goode was talking, when Stein and, you know, whatever the socialists were talking, you know, I hear it differently as I build this constitutional awareness. The more if we create the environment, however it happens, but the more people we get in this conversation, and Rex could probably speak on this more than I'm speculating, but I would assume that this is what Ron Paul has done in his movement, is he's fueled the knowledge, and the knowledge then fueled the drive for change.
Well, but, you know, here's one of the things that I did, you know, and this is why I asked the question at the top of the hour that I asked, you know, is if Congress, think about this, do you really know the, if Congress has the authority to declare war, would it not also stand to reason that they also retain the authority to undeclare war? And if they do, what is the constitutional premise by which they do that?
That's a good question. Why have they stopped the wars that Obama's doing?
Well, think about it. Well, you know, and here's another question, and I'm not going to answer that one yet. I'll come back to it. But here's another question, and I try to evoke these because especially at tea parties where I've got a bunch of veterans out there who have sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and they say, uphold the Constitution, uphold the Constitution. I'm like, look, folks, I'm going to demonstrate to you that you don't really know the Constitution that you think you do. And if you think you can uphold the Constitution without knowing it, then you're a bunch of fools. And that's what people have been doing. They uphold the Constitution, uphold the Constitution, but they really don't know what's in it and why it's so important. They know they get the sense of, you know, there's something important about it, but what is it? I don't know. For instance, Article 1, Section 8, again, in the midst of this, I go out and I ask the veterans, I said, okay, who has the authority to appoint officers in the Army? And people raise their hands. Well, Congress.
It's
the president.
Congress
or the president. Hey, let's take a look, and I'll open the Constitution. In fact, the next time I'm doing this, I'm going to have a member of the audience actually read it rather than I read it, because I think it'll be a little bit more impactive. But Article 1, Section 8, and it's about the surrounding around the 16th clause that says here's the power of Congress and their authority and their mandated duty to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. That would certainly be the Army. Wouldn't you agree?
Mm-hmm.
It says, reserving, here's the next. This part is the important part. Reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers. Where does it say that Congress has the authority or the president has the authority to appoint officers in the Army?
Ah, but we have precedent. We have precedent that the militia
yeah, it's
are
a precedent
different than the standing army.
Yeah, well, that's certainly what they would say, but that's not what the Constitution says. It makes a pretty specific definition.
Are you serious? Are you serious? Isn't that their attitude?
You know,
Pelosi,
I'm never serious.
Mrs. Pelosi, where does it say that in the Constitution? Are you serious? Yeah, that's the document you took an oath to uphold and defend, you moron. Yeah, Randy, you're absolutely right. I mean, the fact is that we don't know the Constitution. If we don't know the Constitution, we don't know the rules of engagement, then how are we holding anybody accountable to anything? The only rule that we seem to understand is the rule of monopoly. And what I mean by that is the Parker Brothers.
I played that once.
If you've ever played Monopoly and you've ever read the rules, it says that the bank can never run out of money. And if the banker runs out of money, any piece of paper can be used to fabricate more money to continue the game. That's the only rule that is in existence right now. And it trumps Article 1, Section 8, Article 1, Section 9, the entire Article 1, Article 2, the whole thing. And until we understand that, we're just tinkering around the edges. But what Randy said is absolutely 100% very clear. And, I mean, you know, we keep saying the NDAA is repealing the Bill of Rights, the NDAA. Well, does anybody really know what the NDAA is? I mean, what is
the war on drugs? The war on drugs.
Yeah.
Nancy Reagan.
You know, I remember we had one guy call in at one point, and I brought up the NDAA provision section 1021 and 1023, and he said, I'm not really worried about, you know, some Hollywood privacy rights or copyright rights on a server. And I didn't know what he was talking about until I re-listened to the show and realized he was talking about that CIPSA or whatever the hell that bill was. He didn't even know what we were talking about.
Right.
The NDAA is a requirement because, as Randy just pointed out in Article 1, Section 8, it specifically says that no appropriation of money to the use of supporting an army shall be for a longer term than 2 years, which is why we need a national defense authorization every 2 years if we have a standing army, because Congress does not have the authority to perpetually fund an army. They have to keep reauthorizing. It's sort of like, you know, we haven't had a budget in 3 years, but we have these continuing resolutions. It's just legal trickery. They found a way to have a standing army without, quote, violating the Constitution. And the fact is, this is a serious, serious problem, because if you give them an inch, they will take a mile, and that's precisely why we have what we have. And when they appoint the officers, here's the real problem with this, that I think Randy was pointing out. When they appoint the officers, it doesn't matter the virtue and honor of your fighting men and women, because if you can appoint the officers that you want and they're sympathetic to your political agenda, then the army could very easily become a detriment to liberty.
Absolutely, and that was the fear of our founding fathers, which is exactly why they put that in the Constitution the way they did. They had this they had this fear of a standing army. They were petrified of a standing army. They knew what a standing army could do and how it could
you
be used against its people. And but here's the thing: they understood it, but they also understood the necessity for a well-trained army ready to take on any force that would come against us. They also understood it was important to have a well-trained, a well-regulated, a well-disciplined army ready to take on the forces of the world. So they didn't just cough up and say, you know, we're just going to leave this to the states and willy-nilly hope that they can do something. No, they put in provisions that Congress was to regulate, arm, discipline, all of that. But the appointment of the officers, as Rex very eloquently pointed out, was to be appointed by the states, because then the loyalty remains within the state and they could never be used against the state.
And to that point, Randy, there was one of our great founders, Thomas Jefferson, who said that banking establishments are more dangerous than even standing armies. And we know how they disdain standing armies. And these things go hand in hand.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you connect the dots and see it for yourself, it's just almost overwhelming. You know, the day I connected the dots of the 16th and the 17th and the Federal Reserve all together in that 1 year, I mean, it was just a, you know, I mean, talk about a light that went on. It was like a, you know, a multi-million candle watt light bulb that went off with that.
And now you're running against foil hats.
How do we change it?
We have to assert our authority. And I think that it's what Randy said earlier was very important. It's about education, because the people have the power. And as long as the majority of the people abdicate that power, you'll have fits and starts against this tyranny, but it will eventually rule the day. I mean, eventually it will rule the day anyway, but that could be 1,000 or 1,000,000 years from now. We don't know, but it doesn't have to be on our watch. And so it's about informing the people that the way that it works, and if you just stop to actually digest the words that we use instead of just glossing over them as, you know, repetitive cognitive regurgitation, when we say that our rights are inherent to us given by our Creator, and that they are unalienable, it means that you cannot even abrogate those rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It doesn't mean that you can give them away. You don't even have the power to give them away. What you do have the power to do is to cede a portion of the power associated with those rights to a delegate. And the way that we do that is we delegate some authority to our local representatives who in Congress in our states are delegated specific powers within our state, and the states cede a portion of that power to the delegates in Congress on the federal level. And it's very easy to point that example out with the well-regulated militia and the army. The fact is that if you have a well-regulated militia, it pretty much means that every able-bodied man, adult male, is prepared to serve in our armed forces at any given moment by training and discipline. That doesn't mean that they have to. They are not necessarily to be conscripted, just trained to be prepared to do that at the state level. However, in times of national war, hold that thought for just a second, though. Sure.
Hold that, because I just want to interject. Hold that thought, but go on. The fact is that the Illinois State Constitution, Article 12, which is titled Militia, actually makes exactly that point. Militia. Who is members of the militia? It is every able-bodied person, and that's why it's important to know this and all of that. So go on. I just want to make the point that even the state constitution makes that point. Every able-bodied person is a member of the militia.
Exactly. And then the fact is that if Congress declares war, and the reason that it's in Congress is because the House is the popular expression of the people in a democratic manner, and the Senate is supposed to be the expression of the states in a Republican manner. If combined, they declare war because of an emergency. Now, of course, you know, the president can call up the army if, let's say, you know, all of a sudden troops are marching up through Mexico and invading our country. There's no time for a, you know, committee meeting. You would just declare war. You know, the president would exercise his authority, and then Congress would then convene and declare war. But once they declare war, then the militias are supposed to be directed in tandem because it's a national situation, which is precisely why Congress has the power to train and regulate them. That way there are uniform regulations for the entire military, although it is always a state power until such time as there is a formal declaration of war.
And to go further, you know, there's another argument out there that will say, but if you just leave the states to, you know, regulate themselves and all, you know, how are you going to get, you know, all these dysfunctional military units together and fight as a cohesive unit and all of that? And I'm like, let's just take a look at what's going on with the UN forces, which I, you know, that's another ball of wax. But just to make the point is that, look, if you can do it across nations, are you telling me you can't do it with a state that has the regulation, the discipline, and all of that, that is the power of the Congress to make sure those standards are met across this nation? Come on.
Lincoln was able to do that. He called up the state militias and invaded my country.
Exactly.
And now what they didn't expect was that their incompetent generals couldn't withstand the military prowess of General Robert E. Lee. But interestingly enough, Lincoln originally asked Robert E. Lee to run his army, and being an honorable man, he said, "Look, I'm pro-Union. However, I gotta side with my country first, which is the Commonwealth of Virginia." And I think that's the honorable attitude. We are all Americans, but if you're going to force me to choose between the federal government and my state wins because I live here. And that's a, you know,
and that's another important thing. That's another important point that, you know, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, you know, really kind of destroyed that concept because everybody was a member of the state, not the nation.
So, Rex, you're saying I have to defend Ohio? Oh, man.
No, you don't. You do not have to defend Ohio at all, Robert. You can do the most important and powerful thing you can do as a sovereign is you can vote with your feet. You can move.
Well,
you can defend Virginia or Texas or Arizona instead.
Well, technically I can move, but there's things that keep me here. But, yeah, I understand the point, though. I was being facetious because Sammy used to introduce me on a show, he'd say, from the great state of Ohio, and I'm just like, well, they went for Obama in 2008, and it went for Romney in 2012. So I'll hold off on the great state part of Ohio.
Well, just get rid of Boehner, and you can be great again.
There you go. Actually, was that through my understanding, Kelly Mordecai said he may have some information about voting machines that might actually prove that Rick Santorum, actually won Ohio and not Romney.
What difference does it make? He didn't win the convention either.
Well, that's true.
So who cares if he did or didn't win Ohio? I mean, it doesn't make a difference. And
well, between Ohio and the voting for, you know, it just. I just feel a little better with knowing Ohioans voted for Santorum than Romney, but just a very small, minute amount better.
Yeah, I mean, look, Santorum at least is a I mean, he's a rhino without a doubt, but he's, you know, not nearly as bad as Romney is, and at least he's somewhat principled in our cultural values. But the other interesting thing that I think, since we're talking about Article 1, Section 8, which, I mean, you could do a whole week's worth of shows on it, the last power there is possibly the most important and the most abused. And I'll tell you, it is to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution, and here's the important part, the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. It's very important because a lot of people say, well, it's necessary and proper for us to do this, necessary and proper for us to do that. That was put there because the Founding Fathers didn't want to hamstring Congress into not being able to execute the very powers that it has in the future. Because if you notice, Article 1, Section 8 mentions nothing about an Air Force. But yet it is a constitutional provision of the military power because they can exercise any laws necessary and proper to these specific powers or any specific powers mentioned in the Constitution. But there is nothing in the Constitution that mentions Congress abdicating its authority over regulation of coin. It doesn't mention any power into going putting our military under command of foreigners. It doesn't give any power for indefinite detention of American citizens. So you know, what's necessary and proper is for people to understand what's necessary and proper is for us to hold them accountable to this very document and not some kind of convoluted precedent-setting analysis by Yale and Harvard-educated morons. As Shakespeare said, first
I would challenge you, though. I would challenge you on that one point. I don't think that particular clause is the most abused. I think it's the number two clause, to borrow money on the credit of the United States. I think that's the one most abused.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree. I will concede the point. I was being dramatic for the point of making my point. But, yes, I agree with you because borrowing money is an important power because in times of war you may not actually have the funds to do it, and if you're truly being invaded, you don't have much of a choice. You've got to defend it, and you might go into debt. But I think that it is absolutely abused because it's practically every ballot in every state is going to have some kind of bond referendum on it, and people blindly always go in and say, oh, well, you know, I like parks, so I'm going to vote yes. Or, you know, schools are good, so I'm going to vote yes. And what you're essentially doing is you're voting and say, okay, you know what, my children's children's children are now going to be on the hook for this crappy boondoggle that the government wants to undergo. And if you're truly going to be an American, and as Randy pointed out, to borrow money not only on the federal level but the state level, don't vote yes on any bond provision. No more debt, period. And here's the problem. We all, if we'll read this document and we'll say, well, it makes sense and I agree with this, then you'll have to come to the conclusion where people like Virgil Goode and Ron Paul are chided about bringing these things up. You'll have to come to the conclusion that Medicare and Social Security are illegal. And then, of course, it'll be like, well, you know, I agree with the Constitution, but don't take away my Medicare and my Social Security. As long as you're thinking in those terms, we will never stem the tide of tyranny, ever.
How is Medicare and Social Security illegal, I mean, constitutionally?
There is no power in the Constitution that allows the federal government to become an insurance company or a pension provider other than for military and possibly public servants.
Right, they try to hide it in putting it as a tax, but then, you know, you go back to what Rex just said.
So in this part, we've never really talked about this, even though most of us know that the communists and socialists were early, in the early 1900s, around this same era, got their footholds into America too. How have the liberals taken so much of our laws and our courts and our government to the extent to where we have a dependent nation? And I know the Republicans are guilty of it too, but that's been their goal from day one.
I think, honestly, my personal assessment is that it has been done and perpetrated because Christians do not know what the Bible says about their particular responsibility, and they are quite comfortable with letting somebody else do it. You know, the Bible is very clear that it was the church's duty to take care of the widows, and, you know, basically welfare is what it amounted to.
Mm-hmm.
And where the Christians allowed, you know, the abdication of their own duties, then the federal government says, well, you know what? You don't want to do it, no problem. We'll take care of that for you.
Mm-hmm.
Nature abhors
a vacuum. Are you saying the church? But the churches have always been, have done a lot.
Well, that's where the word charity. You know, the Old Testament or the King James version of love was charity. That's where charity came from, love, and the Christians were supposed to love, and there was this idea of charity, you know, that we've taken and said, well, you know, if you're going to be have love, you're going to be charitable, you're going to give, and that's totally out of the Bible, and what people don't understand is where that word charity came from. It's supposed to be a Christian thing, not a government thing.
Mm-hmm. And what you say, Randy, is absolutely correct, because in Latin, caritas means love, and that's where we absolutely draw the term charity. It's supposed to be loving, and if we truly understand what it means that you don't give somebody merely what they need materially. The whole point of charity is that you
change.
Are supposed to empower the person
mm-hmm.
to be able to provide what they need, and only those who are incapable of providing what they need for themselves is it now our, not legal, but our moral responsibility to provide for them. And a perfect example of that, and this is, you know, again, when we start talking about immigration and all these things, like, you know, we're anti-immigrant. Well, no, we're not anti-immigrant, but we have 22% of our population unemployed, which means they cannot provide for their families, and it is uncharitable of us to invite foreigners into our lands until those who already live here legally have employment and can provide for themselves. And it was very evident when the first immigrant waves of Catholics came to these United States, which is ostensibly a Protestant country, given the fact that the only colony with an established church that was not Protestant to some degree was Maryland. And Catholics were, at some point, not permitted to vote. They were also not permitted to work in many places. And in many cases, widows and orphans were destitute because of this. And there were no government programs to take care of them. And that's where the Knights of Columbus formed a fraternal organization to provide those benefits for the widows and orphans, irrespective of faith, but principally to take care of their Catholic communities. Now, that is something that is done voluntarily. It is done privately as an organization. It is done in true charity. And it did not require government funding or government assistance. And today, the Knights of Columbus is one of the top-rated insurance companies in the country. It's not only, you know, a very powerful financial power, but it does a lot of good charitable things in the true sense of charity with love. This is precisely what our founding fathers envisioned, that we would take the responsibility to do these things ourselves and that the government would only step in acute situations for a temporary period of time to satisfy these things when it cannot be satisfied. For example, you have an invasion by a foreign country, let's say they come up through Mexico and they decimate Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and Southern California. Then it would be incumbent upon our government, after defeating that enemy, to provide the rebuilding of that infrastructure and assistance to those people until such time as things are normalized, and then it would be incumbent upon our federal government to step out. So again, and this is a very important thing, and I'll tell you why it's really important, because there are allegedly 70 million professed Catholics in this country, and the church has always taught something called the principle of subsidiarity, which is very similar to our concept of federalism. And it means that whenever you have a problem, it is always incumbent upon the lowest order to take care of it, starting with the family, the community, the town, the county, the state government, and then and only then the federal government. And that means that it goes in order. And if it cannot be taken care of by the lowest order because of lack of funding, lack of resources, organizational incapacity, then it would go to the next highest order, which is precisely why the war power was given to the federal government, because if you have a national invasion, then you need a national response. And that's precisely how we have to start looking at things, and then we would solve these problems. So when you say, well, you know, retired people couldn't function without Social Security. Sure they could. In Galveston, Texas, they decoupled from Social Security in 1984 and bought private insurance annuities, and right now the recipients of those retirement benefits are getting anywhere between 3 and 7 times what they would have received under Social Security. So that's how things are supposed to be done, and until we understand that and are willing to forego some of these, quote, freebies, but they're not really free, even if someone else is not paying for it, and you might be paying for it yourself. I put my money in, so I get my money out. It's not free because it comes with strings and behavioral controls, and that's precisely what makes you subservient to the system of tyranny. And we have to break free of that, and that requires courage and education, which is precisely what we have to do. Otherwise, all of these discussions become nothing more than academic.
Right. And what you just said, Rex, gives so much strength and power to the quote from John Adams, who said, "This Constitution is for a moral and religious people only, and is totally inadequate for the government of any other because of those very specific principles that you have just espoused." That gave so much strength and weight to that statement to help people understand the importance of why John Adams would say this Constitution is for the government of a moral and religious people, because without it being a moral, religious people, we get exactly what we're getting now.
Mm-hmm. And it was Reagan who said that if we are not a nation under God, we will be a nation gone under. And he's absolutely right.
So when we had the Great Depression and all these social programs kicked in, this was really the beginning of the government becoming the social program deliverer in this country.
I don't know that it was necessarily specifically the Depression that did it, but it was certainly a factor.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
the progressive experiment was before the Depression.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, look. The fact is that let's be clear about a couple of things. Communism might have been invented by Hegel or Weishaupt or even Marx and Engels, I don't know, in Germany. But it was essentially first adopted by Bismarck and second adopted here. You know, we had a socialist running for president, and, you know, the third parties don't work. Well, this socialist party kept on running and running and running and garnering a significant amount of the vote, and slowly the Democratic Party just adopted every single one of those provisions, and since then the Republican Party has gone along with it, and now you effectively have pretty much all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto for a communist revolution legally functioning within the United States. And no one stops to think about that. But the fact is it's happened. But it's just instead of doing it all at once in one fell violent swoop, they did it gradually over a 100-year period so that you will accept it. And by taking little nibbles of socialism, you're now socialist. Now, some people think that socialism is a good thing, which it isn't. But even if you do think that, the fact is that socialism and communism are never the end game. They are merely, just like capitalism,
exactly,
and free, you know, and manipulated free markets, they are merely a path to corporatism. And that's what it's all
exactly
about.
Well, and one of the other things that's kind of interesting, if you study the history, you know, coming into, you know, the arena of this wanting to declare independence, and, you know, when the colonies were first getting started, you know, when the folks from the Mayflower came over and all. What's real interesting is, you know, people use the term, this great experiment called America. Well, you know, what's funny about that is they did experiment with socialism.
Yep.
They did experiment
right
with all of these things, and they found them all to be failures. That's why they created the system that they did. They already experimented with them and determined they're failures.
Yep.
Because everybody performs differently. Everybody has a different level of charity. Everybody has a different level of selfishness. The early colonies, there's a talk show radio, I don't know if you guys have ever listened to it, Michael Medved. He's on one of our stations here, and he's probably, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7 in the nation.
I've heard of him, yeah.
Yeah, he does some great historical stuff. He's in the Seattle market where I live, And he does some great historical stuff. And on Thanksgiving, he likes to go all the way back to the, you know, the early, camps. They weren't, you know, settlements. And he goes through all of this stuff. And, it, and it's been incredibly educational.
Well, the fact is, and he's absolutely right. And if you can look at Plymouth Colony under, we have Governor Bradford Morris's notes, and that's the one that's usually used as an example because we always assume that the first Thanksgiving was in 1624 in Massachusetts. But the same exact experiment with communism and the abandonment of communism for private property was done before that at the Jamestown settlement here in Virginia. But it just wasn't transmitted to the Massachusetts colony, and so they had to learn the lesson on their own. And the fact is that any time that you have private property with a moral people, then you will always have abundance and provision for all. When you have a communistic system, it harbors and breeds greed. Socialism and communism are built on greed. Capitalism, truly understood as free markets, is not built on greed. It is built on service. Communism is about being greedy enough to use the powers of government to acquire as much as possible with the least amount of effort from your neighbor by force. And true capitalism is about providing the largest benefit to the largest number of people in order to earn a customer. And we have been taught all along that communism and socialism are based on altruism and that capitalism is based on greed. You know, that whole Gordon Gekko speech, greed is good, and it'll save not only Teldar paper, but also this malfunctioning corporation called the United States of America. That is part of the subtle manipulation through the media to convince us that capitalism is greedy, capitalism understood as free markets, and communism and socialism are somehow, nice and based on altruism.
And to go off of this and go to the point back about, you know, how did Christians abdicate all this? Well, you know, as we know, you know, Satan, if you believe in him, you know, and if you don't, it's still a truism regardless, is the fact that there was just a little bit of a twist. You know, people, a lot of Christians look at the early church where it said, and everybody gave, you know, they sold all their goods and gave to the poor so that no one was without need. And they say, man, that was the best form of communism. And so communism must be pretty good. And so, you know, to have a benevolent government to do this for us would be, you know, representative of a Christian government. Do you see how those are all twisted and convoluted?
Yeah.
I mean, that's because we have, you know, that lack of education again.
But through taxes for those folks to get the money, it's forced. Because you don't mean giving through charity is much different than than the government taking your money so that you can pay for social programs. I mean, that's pretty much forced. You don't pay your taxes, you know, get fined, go to jail, what have you. But if you give charitably, then that's actually something that's coming from yourself. You know, it's not something that's forced. So that's where there's the big difference between those two.
Then not just that, you look at the percentage of money that gets to the people. Like if they steal $100 from me to ultimately go to that person in need, and of course we can't define that need because now the government controls it. So that's a breakdown of the system right there. But that's the lowest return on that $100 they stole from me than if I went out and I gave it to a charity who actually that's what they do for a living. And it's amazing you can see those statistics, and yet people still buy into that crap. They want government to deal with it.
It goes a step further than that, Chris, because when they steal $100 from you, they're only servicing the debt that they allegedly use to provide that social benefit, which they don't really provide.
To
go forward and say that, communism sounds great, well, you know what? In a sense, it is. And if you really think about it, you'll realize that it is, because every household, every family is essentially communistic, because it is from the needs of the provider of the family, from the ability of the provider of the family to the needs of the family. But that is a family situation where it works. And what Randy was referring to in the scripture, that was a voluntary organization. And if you notice, at one point, one of the couples sold all of their worldly possessions to give to the community, but they actually reserved some for themselves, and they were chastised. And people say, see, so the Bible is very clear about chastising people for not being communists, but the fact is they weren't chastised for that. They were chastised because they said that they were giving away all of their wealth in order to provide for the community, and then they reserved some for themselves. But they were never required to sell everything to give to the community. And that's the difference, is that it is a choice of who you give to and what you do, and it is a moral obligation, not a government obligation.
And to chime in, gentlemen, there's about 6 minutes left before Blog Talk Radio, let me get an echo, but before Blog Talk Radio will pretty much turn us off, because there's only about an hour left, I mean an hour of record time. But I just want to get in, speaking of charity, you can go to the Bard's Logic Political Talk website and go to the Give page and find a way where you can, for, you mentioned $100, but only for $50 a year, you can adopt a orphaned baby elephant that's parents were killed by poachers. So if anyone is looking to do any charitable works, then I think, you know, that's one of them that I would like for people to look at, and you can see that on the website. And so, as I said, we've only got about 4 or 5 minutes, and I'd like to close it out. So there's three of you guys, so go ahead and each get a minute for anything closing you'd like to say before we get shut off.
Well, I think that it's been another incredible conversation. We covered a lot of stuff tonight. I really believe that it comes back to education, that we're creating the environment. You know, I look at some new people that just came on my group, you know, and the first thing I said was read the about and then go into the files and start listening to the radio shows, you know, because we can't do it all. We need that. We need the system to work for us. Got to build those environments. And keep feeding people. I think the draw, and I don't know this, if this is true for everybody, but the more I understand about the Constitution, the more, because really the political questions and conversations don't answer the problem. The Constitution, you know, addresses the problem, and it changes the way you look at the political environment. You know, it's like everybody's always looking at politics to solve the problem. Well, yeah, that ain't going to get solved there. Where the solution is at is in the document and the original intent and what our founding fathers were trying to put together and why they did it, because there's a lot of knowledge behind, you know, their choices, you know, historical knowledge of the civilizations of the world in terms of how they put this thing together. And I think that becomes the conversation that draws people in, and then the political questions start answering themselves, because now you have a foundation. I'm done.
Well, I guess I'll take next. And I, you know, I've got a website, Constitutionally Correct. The premise behind it is to give many of those found. I mean, I've got one called The Evolution of Freedom. And it's, you know, it starts back at the, I just lost the name of it, but the one that King. But it's all about education. And, you know, we've got to provide, you know, it's just like, you know, asking the question, what is the constitutional premise behind undeclaring war? Rex mentioned it, you know, to unfund it, to pull the money every 2 years. Congress has the ability to totally say, hey, we're done, pull the money, it's done, it's over with. And once people start to understand that, and that's what I love to see, is when I see the aha moment, you know, when I see the veteran say, you know, well, let's read what the Constitution actually has to say about it. I've seen their jaws drop open when they suddenly realize, you know, they've been, you know, championing support the Constitution, and they haven't been supporting the Constitution. They've been supporting some convoluted notion as to what it is. And so you're absolutely right. It is absolutely incumbent upon us to learn and to teach and to create this hunger in people to know what it actually says. And so I just really appreciate this opportunity to be here amongst you guys, and thanks for all that you're doing. And let's just keep on doing this, because, you know, I got a sense that, you know, it's working. And I saw that yesterday when I saw an auditorium filled, not with people supporting the two-party duopoly, but people who were coming in there to hear an alternative to that. And that has fired me up ever since.
Cool. Did you take film of it?
That's great.
You know, You know, I wish I had of. You know, I should have taken a picture of the auditorium, but I didn't think about it at the time.
Okay. Shame on you.
Go ahead, Rex.
Well, I will just say, pick up the Constitution and read it, and also learn the lessons from the Bible. And if you are not a Christian, that's okay, because your salvation is between you and Jesus. And if you're not a believer, that's okay. But understand something, that our culture and our documents, our founding documents, and our sense of liberty is based in Western civilization, which used to be called Christendom. And you have to understand it from a cultural perspective if you truly seek liberty. So read the Bible, even if you don't read it as a spiritual document, merely as a historical document, and the Constitution, an armed